Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Yeah, I just turned my phone on a couple of seconds ago, and it was way too bright, so I had to check it, turn it down a bit. Life is crazy. You know, like I said, it's Friday. Fridays are kind of catch-up day around here. I have no idea what's going to happen. We got to find Alan Dawson a new time because he has not been able to check in for quite a while during this time. Alan Dawson calls in from Belize, so we get our Belize information. We get our latest food information. Yeah, man, we talk like this. We have a great time. It's wonderful to talk to people from the Caribbean. You know, and I do accents for fun, so please don't take offense if I totally screw up your accent, because you'll probably totally screw up mine too. So you know, it works out very well. Anyway, so I got half an hour here. Shirley's going to join us at the bottom of the hour. Shirley Watchell, excuse me, Watchell. I got to get her name right. I mean, it's the least I can do. I still owe her a theme. I mean, I feel terrible about that, so I'm going to create that. But it's been a busy week. In fact, yesterday I played guitar for like 4 hours with another guitar player, and hopefully this will be the beginning of probably my 30th band. I've been playing in bands for about 40 years, and none too successfully, obviously, but they've all had varying degrees of success. I would say 90% of them never made it on stage because usually a member would quit. Something would go wrong. Somebody wouldn't practice. Somebody just couldn't play the parts because they just, you know, they said they were better than they actually were, which is a common theme with musicians. Yeah, I can play that. Okay, go ahead. And you wait and go, okay, yeah, okay, right. So as they say, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. The proof of the player is in the playing. Oh, you didn't know that expression, the proof of the pudding is in the eating? You thought the proof was in the pudding? You know, what kind of an idiot would put proof in pudding? That doesn't, intellectually, that makes no sense. So all you folks, it's just a pet peeve of mine. All you folks out there saying the proof is in the pudding, go find it. And what kind of pudding is it? Yorkshire pudding? You know, butterscotch pudding? I mean, what pudding would you put your proof in? You know, that's why the expression is the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Well, the proof of the player is in the playing. You know, what's the proof of the politician? In the politicking? I mean, I don't know. I'm just making this stuff up. Anyway, so I was going to do a show today. A continuation of yesterday on the many reasons why everybody should unregister from whatever, if you're unregistered from the major parties, the Democrat and Republican Party. The Democrats because they're Marxists and the Republicans because they're geldings. And so I've done it. I did it after the November election when they ruled and installed Brandon in a coup, and the gelding GOP did nothing about it. In fact, they actually helped. And so I thought, that's it. I'm out. I want nothing to do with any party. I was only staying in the GOP for the primaries, and then I realized that they were giving me lousy choices anyway. And so I'll probably end up voting, you know, for either other party people, independent candidates, writing in myself, even though I don't really want the office. I'm going to do something. But I think that the more people that leave the dominant parties, the better off we're going to be. Because if they have no parties, they have nowhere to go for money. They'll be left with big corporate donors, you know, and the corporate donors are going to go, wait a minute, you don't have a party. You got no members. Why should we donate to you? And so this whole thing will snowball, and we'll get rid of these parties as quickly as possible and actually have the members of Congress have to stand on their own. You know, and that's the whole point of this, is to get the parties out of Congress. In fact, I would actually out membership in a party when anybody's in a legislature for the simple reason that it's too much influence. You look at the vote to install the racist Marxist Judge Jackson. Okay. Oh, it's historic. All right. But not for the reasons everybody's saying. The fact that she's a black woman is irrelevant. Okay, what's significant is that she's a racist Marxist. She believes in racist theory in schools, and she's Marxist. She has no use for the Constitution whatsoever. She said as much. She can't define a woman, which means she's absolutely, you know, knuckled under to the leftist ideology, and she has no business on the court. You know, in fact, most of them don't, including conservatives. The only two people who have any business on the court are Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas. Everybody else has to come off for what I would call bad behavior, you know, supporting things like judicial review, which isn't in the Constitution. We get a bill on that, too. But if you look at the Constitution, it says for terms of good behavior. So we've got hopefully an hour with Shirley. I don't know how much time she has. I'll find out when we get her on the show. But one of the things that I wanted to talk about is the fact that I have an idea for a congressional yearly oversight of the Supreme Court. You know, after each session. So I think the session ends in like October. So before their Christmas recess, Congress should do an oversight of the Supreme Court and see if they conform to principles of good behavior based on Article 3 of the Constitution. And I'll be talking about that. I'm going to try and do a meet and greet tomorrow with Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's in town, who's in the Florida Panhandle, with Representative Matt Gaetz as they kick off their Friends of Matt Gaetz campaign thing again. It was in one place, and now they moved it to three places, so they've picked the most Crestview, Jay, I think, and McAdams. Anyway, they picked some of the three of the most remote places in Santa Rosa County to do these little meet and greets, which I think is hysterical. So obviously they got too many people, and so that's good for them, but it should be interesting to see how it works out. Anyway, so before the show, I'm thinking to myself, all right, I can do the party thing. I've talked about the party thing. I talked about it yesterday. I can do it again today. Be a good follow-up. I got some articles on it. I'll see if I get to them. It depends how long Chappie's report is. But I thought, you know what? Let's see how many I haven't done a COVID thing for a while. So I wanted to sort of check and see the latest stats on COVID and see how bad the problem really was. Well, it's bad. It's really bad. And so let me see where I put my oh, there we go. There it is. And so I thought to myself, well, let's check on the athletes. And I was watching a report on One American News, and they were talking about, you know, Pearson Sharp was doing his thing on how many athletes have died. And I thought, well, let me check out and see. You know, he's talking about athletes that have died. Perfectly healthy young athletes, some of the healthiest people in the world that have dropped dead right on the field, right during play. And I thought, well, let's find out how bad this really is. So I wrote a little Facebook tweet, which you guys can take. And I said, when you lose the world's healthiest athletes to the jab and everyone else is in denial, we have many massive problems. Yeah, many massive problems. So I found this website after, you know, poking around for a while. And again, the secret to using the internet is to ask the right questions. If you don't ask the right questions, you don't get the answers you're looking for. You get a whole bunch of crap. And the answer you're looking for is on page, you know, 18 of the search. Anyway, so I found this website called Real Science. Science needs open discussion. Anything else is totalitarianism. Should have had a comment in there after discussion. But anyway, I nitpick. Yeah, exactly. Science needs open discussion. Anything else is totalitarianism. COVID went on for 2 years, not because of the virus, but because of the government illegal policies. COVID would have been done with in July of 2020. CDC proved that when they published a chart showing the death rate for July of 2020 was heading for zero. Well, you didn't know that. I've got the chart. I'll post it sometime again. Yeah, it's right there. You can't find it anymore, of course, because, you know, if everybody knew, you know, what I've shared with countless times, that COVID death rate was heading for zero by mid-July 2020, there'd be an open revolt country. That's why they have to suppress the information. So more suppressed information, we do more suppressed information today. So this is the place you come for the ultimate free speech zone. This is the place you come to find out things that a few other people will tell you because either they don't have the guts, they have a boss, they have a program director, an operations director who's knuckling under to woke advertisers or, for whatever reason. You know, maybe the Brandon in the White House calls him up and, you know, yells at him in some incoherent verbiage. But we don't have that problem here. So you can come on the show and say pretty much what you want. As long as you don't, you know, personal attacks, mention names of people that are private citizens and want to stay private. Other than that, I really don't care. So I found this website called Real Science at goodsciencing.com/COVID/athletes, suffer cardiac arrest, die after COVID shot. And it says it is definitely not normal for so many mainly young athletes to suffer from cardiac arrest or to die while playing the sport. But this year it is happening. Many of these heart issues and deaths come shortly after they got a COVID vaccine. While it is possible this can happen to the people who did not get COVID vaccine, the sheer numbers clearly point to the only obvious cause. By the way, you notice nobody died of a COVID shot during the Chinese Communist Olympics? I just thought of that. I find it interesting. I mean, it'd be interesting to know if somebody actually did die of a COVID shot during the Chinese Communist Olympics, and the Chinese, of course, suppressed that, and you never heard about it. That'd be interesting. I'm going to find that. I'm going to write that down. Did anybody die? This is the ADHD brain at work, right? So I'll get this weird thought thing. Okay, I got to find out about that. Anybody wants to look it up and call me 215-383-3832. And the question is, did any athletes? When I write fast, I write impossible to read, so I got to slow down a bit. Athletes die of a COVID shot during the Olympics. Die of COVID shot. COVID shot. I'm sorry. I should have taken a break and do this. During, let's call it the CCP Olympics. During Chinese Communist Party Olympics. Now, that would be suppressed information, so you may never know. Anyway, back to the article. The so-called health professionals running the COVID vaccine programs around the world keep repeating that the COVID vaccine is a normal vaccine and it is safe and effective. Now, you know and I know that none of that's true. But they keep reading the mantra. It's like in the movie, The Manchurian Candidate. The real one, the original one, another one, Denzel Washington. And I love Denzel Washington as an actor. He's fabulous. But he was in a lousy version of The Manchurian Candidate. The real one with Frank Sinatra and Angela Lansbury and I've forgotten the other guy, that Lawrence Harvey. There we go. Fabulous film. But they all get brainwashed and they keep repeating this line. You know, Raymond Shaw is the kindest, gentlest, most wonderful person in the whole wide world. And they repeat it like a mantra because that's their brainwashing. Guy was an absolute terror. He was horrible. He was a total, you know, A something, right? Okay. He's one of those guys. But they kept repeating the mantra because that's what they were told. So imagine like walking into the Center for, you know, for Direct Control, the CDC, Center for Direct Control, and you hear this playing over and over. It'd be like something out of 1984. The COVID vaccine is a normal vaccine and it is safe and effective. The COVID vaccine is a normal vaccine and it is safe and effective. I mean, you can just hear that kind of stuff going on, right? So, and they'll greet you at the door. Hello, welcome to the CDC. Have you had your brainwashing today? Oh, no? Okay, fine. Sit here with this headset for half an hour and listen to this, and then we'll talk to you. The COVID vaccine is a normal vaccine and it is safe and effective. Beep, beep. Anyway, so that's what I think goes on there. Just my speculation. Article says, so in response to their pronouncement, here is a non-exhaustive and continuously growing list of mainly young athletes who had major medical issues in the 2021-2022 after receiving one or more COVID vaccines. I don't usually call them vaccines. I'm doing it for convenience because this article does. I usually call it the snake oil jab. And for those of you internationally, snake oil is a thing that it was like a joke for back in the 1800s when these people would go town to town and market this absolute garbage. Before there were any kind of product safety, any kind of labeling standards, any kind of liability, things like that, they would just, you know, throw whatever, you know, in a bottle, call it snake oil, and sell it until it cures everything. You know, that's why snake oil is such a great metaphor for this. So something that somebody fakes, throws in a bottle, tells you will cure anything, and it could be anything. It could be river water for all you know, right? You know, full of bacteria, amoebas, and things that eat your brain. You don't know. That was the risk back in the 1800s. There were no standards. And so government at its best actually does good things like product standards, you know, advertising requirements. The product has to do what they say it does, things like that. And you can't just make up snake oil. You know, the product, in other words, the medicinal product actually has to work. So by those standards, of course, the experimental COVID snake oil jab wouldn't qualify at all. It would never be on the market because it doesn't do what it says it's supposed to do for obvious reasons we've talked about. And so that's why they make it experimental. And they tell you, you know, it's like if you take something experimental, it's at your risk, even though they're mandating it. See how they get around this stuff? It's really quite fascinating. Back to the article. So in response to their pronouncement, here is a non-exhaustive list. Continuously growing list of mainly young athletes. It says initially many of these were not reported, which is kind of interesting. We know that many people were told not to tell anyone about their adverse reactions and the media was not reporting them. Well, so much for free press, right? Okay. They started happening and ramping up after the first COVID, they're going to say vaccinations, I will say snake oil jabs. The mainstream media still are not reporting most, but sports news cannot ignore the fact that soccer players and other stars collapse in the middle of a game due to a sudden cardiac arrest. Many of these die, more than 50%. Okay, and it's kind of obvious when a healthy 20-something athlete with especially a soccer player with, you know, massive leg muscles and big chest with a great lung capacity, someone in the peak of health, the healthiest people in the world. Soccer players are some of the healthiest athletes in the world because they run up and down continuously on this big wide open field trying to hit this ball or kick this ball and not use their hands. Okay, you got to be healthy. You got to be in great shape to run up and down a soccer field continuously for however long they do it. There's no timeouts, I don't think. You know, and if these people are just and when someone just kind of keels over and drops dead right on the field, you know, everybody's videoing it. It's kind of obvious. So it's not like they can hide this stuff. So then they have to say it was something else, or they have to deny it or change the numbers, and they go through the spin. Right? The spin is basically turning, you know, news into propaganda, reporting what it is. It's like when Jen Psaki, you know, said to Peter Ducey that the fact that Brandon kissed Pelosi on the cheek, which is kind of a disgusting thing to watch, actually, that was not close contact. No, that wasn't really close contact for COVID purposes. Of course, they're not wearing their masks that don't work. But that's not close contact. In other words, don't believe your lying eyes. You know, we'll tell you what you saw. You know, you heard that before, right? Anyway, back to this article. This article is very current, by the way. It goes up to March 2022. So this goes up to last month when we get to the chart. It says, we also note that many posts in Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, forums, and news stories are being removed. So now we are receiving some messages saying there is no proof of the event or of vaccination status. That is partly because this information is being hidden. That's why I'm giving it to you now, because it's being hidden. You know, my test is if I can post it on Facebook. And if I try posting it on Facebook and I get all these warnings saying if you post this, you know, you're going to be condemned to Facebook jail for the rest of your life, I don't post it. But it goes right into the show. So anything I can't post on Facebook is prima facie evidence that I need to put this on the show immediately. Okay, so that's why this article is coming, right? Article says, most people are writing to tell us that in many cases, we didn't mention a person's vaccination status. There's a good reason for that. None of the clubs want to reveal this information. That would be the sports clubs, right? None of their sponsors want to reveal it either. I'm not laughing at the people who died. Okay, don't get me wrong. I'm laughing at the absurdity of the situation, the absurdity of trying to hide the fact that people are dropping dead. Everybody knows why people are dropping dead, yet they're trying to hide the reason that people are dropping dead from the people who already know it. That's funny. I'm sorry. It just is. Article says the players have been told not to reveal it. What, the dead ones do? Most of their relatives will not mention it. None of the media are asking the question. So what should we do? Stop this now? No, we will collect as much information as we can while it is still available. There you go. Then, because eventually more information will come out and we will be here to put it together. Will it mean anything? We don't know. What we do know is that there is a concerted worldwide effort to make this information go away. So that fact alone tells us it must be collected, investigated, and saved so other researchers can look at it to see if there are any useful patterns. And that's what really this is all about. Patterns. I do patterns on the show all the time. I'm always looking for patterns. Right? So we really appreciate the athletes named in this list who have confirmed what happened to them so the truth can be known. They care about their fellow athletes, even in the clubs. Their sponsors, media, and politicians care more about money. There you go. They care about their fellow athletes, even if the clubs, their sponsors, media, and politicians care more about money. Yeah, what's more valuable, money or life? Well, apparently money. Money is more valuable to Dr. Fascist. Money is more valuable to the Democrat Marxists. Money is more valuable to all the public health officials. Money is more valuable to the governors, the mayors, the people that took money for COVID and shut down their economies and killed off people through depression and a bunch of other stuff. So this is quite fascinating. And I'm going to reveal a little bit about the Australian Bill of Rights. We do have a free speech article in there. One of the rights is free speech, but it also calls for the open exchange of information. So in other words, it is a right, you have a right not only to speak, but the right to openly exchange information, which means you have the right to hear other people who are speaking. Those other people cannot be silenced because if they are silenced, you don't have an open exchange of information, which means you have the right to exchange with someone else has the right to exchange with you. Whether that's done personally or over mass media doesn't matter. It's still a right. So it's every bit as much a right to speak as it is a right to receive and share information. This is why the Australian Bill of Rights, when it comes out, is going to be one of the most amazing documents, I believe, in terms of freedom that have been written in a very long time. And I'm very excited about it. So stay tuned. Stay tuned to Action Radio. I mean, obviously, we're going to release it first here in the United States because, you know, I had a fairly big hand in putting it together. So that's what that's all about. So anyway, I'm really proud of it. But that's part of it. But think about that, too. If free speech included the right to a free exchange of information, would we have had a COVID pandemic for 2 years? And the answer, of course, is no. Because the free exchange of information would have given you the knowledge of early treatments. Everybody would have been cured within about 6 weeks, and it would have been done. Think about that. What killed people? COVID? No. The lack of free information. The lack of the exchange of information. That's what killed people, because they got the wrong information. They went on ventilators. Actually, they got remdesivir. They went on ventilators, and they died. Had people known about the remdesivir ventilator death march, had they known about ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, zinc, vitamin D3, and vitamin C, you wouldn't have had a pandemic. It would have been done. In fact, the early articles, I still got them. I've got a whole file of early articles. The early articles that came out on COVID said, there's no problem. We got the cure. Didierot Raoult in Marseille, France. Dr. Vladimir Zelenko here. Doctors around the world, actually, they all came to the same conclusion. Whether they used ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine plus zinc, they realized very quickly this thing could be killed. Well, why would you spend billions of dollars and develop a vaccine when you can kill the virus? Well, if you kill the virus, you don't need a vaccine, which is the point of my bill back in February of 2020, saying that Congress can only spend half their money on the vaccine, but the other half has to be spent on early treatments. Why did I do that? I knew a vaccine wasn't needed. It was never needed. It was never necessary. And the fact that millions of people have taken this for no reason is absolutely horrifying to me. Well, I'm not a genius. I just looked it up. If you've got a cure, you don't need a vaccine. I mean, I could explain that to a five-year-old, and they would understand. And yet millions of grown adults, allegedly, you know, somewhat competent people, took a shot that they never had to take because, but had the information been more available, they would have known, oh, I'm not going to take that vaccine. I've already got a cure. What do I need that for? See, that's what killed you. What killed you was the restriction of your rights, not the virus. Think about that. That's why I wrote that, I didn't write it, but I mean, I helped. But that's why I worked with Jen Clark in Australia to write an Australian Bill of Individual Rights. This is just going to go worldwide. It's only a matter of time. It's going to be a shock to governments. So they're going to go, what? People can't have that much power? Oh, yeah? Stay tuned. Section 2, prior year data. Update 2, the International Olympic Committee in Lausanne, Switzerland, studied documents from international data banks from 1966 to 2004. I see they're right up with the times there. Those documents indicated 1,101 sudden deaths in athletes under 35 years of age, an average of 29 athletes per year, the sports with the highest incidence being soccer and basketball. Well, that makes sense. Those are some of the most athletic sports. I don't think you're going to see a lot of ping pong champions dying or dart champions or archery champions or a number of sports, even football, because they only play about 6 minutes a game. The offense and the defense is about 6 minutes. Actually, you have the ball moving per game. That's it. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but, everything else is timeouts and wasted time and huddles and whatever else they do in football. Anyway, a study by Marin, M-A-R-O-N, on sudden deaths in U.S. athletes from 1980 to 2006 in 38 sports identified 1,866 deaths of athletes with cardiac disease with a prevalence of hypertrophic cardio. I have no idea what that is, but I know hyper is not good. It's a lot. It's just something. Anyway, 2005 to 2006 averaged 66 deaths per year with 82% of those occurring during competition or training. Well, that's pretty much all that sports people do. They're either in competition or they're in training, right? Anyway, thanks to investigator readers, this is a citizen done thing. It's kind of like Action Radio in a way, because they're taking information from people, studying it, compiling it, putting it all together. This is thanks to investigative readers for discovering these reports and the story in Spanish. And they got one there, Momento Deportivo. So I'll send this to Josie if she can translate it for us. In 2021 and 2022, so far, cardiac disease has not been mentioned. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy was mentioned twice, but those two reports were listed in the not vax-related list. Enlarged heart was only mentioned three times, but there was no indication this was a long-term or recent issue, possibly due to vaccine injury. The above shows that in prior years, there were 66 deaths per year, but there have been 86 reported in January 2022 so far. So they have more in a month, by quite a lot. Like it looks like about 25% more in 1 month than they usually have in an entire year. That is what we would call statistically significant. Right. So all the stuff's going on. Military death increases. Here we go. Thomas Renz, an American lawyer, says that the U.S. military's DMED, that's Defense Medical Epidemiology Database, shows that in the first 10 months of 2021, that all-cause morbidity increased 11 times. That's 11,000% for those that can't multiply by 100, which would include me. 11,000% against the previous year. Renz has informed has information from DOD whistleblowers. The DOD is reportedly actively deleting data from the database, possibly to cover up the genocide that has been perpetrated on military personnel. Yeah, and for anybody that remembers Gulf War Syndrome, they gave this vaccine supposedly to prevent anthrax, which I don't think was really a problem. Certain people were getting white powder they said was anthrax in their mail. Well, that's what the problem is. The problem is to go after the people that sent the white powder. The problem is not to vaccinate an entire, military with a snake oil jab that has this chemical called squalene, which is suspected of causing Gulf War Syndrome, which caused massive problems for millions upon millions of service people. Oh, by the way, that's in your flu shot too. Squalene is in your flu shot. Look it up, okay? That's why you shouldn't take a flu shot. In fact, you shouldn't take any of these shots. Don't. Stop doing it. You want to live a healthy life? Exercise, get your weight down, take immune boosters and eat well. That's the secret. You're going to die anyway, but you might as well live as long as possible, as healthy as possible, and have fun while you're here. That's what I'm doing. All right. Good science reports. Our ongoing update to the chart in this post clearly shows that growth of adverse events on sports people. One person said we were hiding things because we're only showing the barest of 2022. Sorry about that, but we don't have a crystal ball to see into the future. The only things we expect are that, A, some people will continue to be surprised about the number of athlete deaths over the coming months, and B, although it is February, injuries and deaths that happened in prior months will continue to be discovered in the future. So yeah, this is within the last few months the study came out. This is and if you want to find it, you know, you just go back in the podcast. Let me give you one more time. 833 athletic cardiac arrests, serious injuries, 540 dead after COVID shot. And the website is Real Science. Headline, Science Needs Open Discussion, Anything Else, Totalitarianism. And the website, goodsciencing.com/COVID/athletes suffer cardiac arrests. Die after COVID shot. There you go. If you missed it, you got the podcast. Okay, good science reporting. Did I say that? Our ongoing updates to the chart in this post clearly shows the growth of adverse events on sports people. Oh, yeah, sorry, I read that one. Okay, dates of first vaccinations, and I use that vaccination term for convenience, not because it's accurate, all right? The dates of first available vaccinations vary all over the world. In different states and different cities, we have a small collection of data in a separate story, which they have a link to that, and we know there were trials in the month before official rollouts. So just because a country started its rollout on a particular date, that doesn't mean some people didn't receive their vaccinations in the weeks and months earlier. If we get definite proof that someone was not vaccinated, we amend the record. Officials and the media are now doing a great job of hiding all the useful information. They are also calling vaccinated people unvaxxed if it hasn't been more than 2 weeks after the vaccination. So in other words, you get the shot, you're still unvaxxed for 2 weeks because most people die in 2 weeks. You know, that's like retirement. When Social Security was created, the eligibility age was 65. Why? Because most people were dead about 52. So they never got there. So it's easy to create a program where they take your money, you know, promising to pay you some of it back upon retirement, and they set an age that most people never get to. That's a great government program, but that's how Social Security works. The problem with Social Security is people are living past the retirement age. Well, that wasn't supposed to happen. You know, so the same thing with this. You know, people are dying of the vaccine, which they're not supposed to do. And so it screws up all of that. This is, one of the fascinating things about the internet that I didn't realize is that, you know, we're all happy with the availability of information. Almost anything you wanted to know was on the internet. But what we didn't know then that we found out now because of COVID is that anything that can be put on the internet could also be removed from the internet. We didn't think that could happen. We thought once it's there, it's there. You know, public record. I think they have Wayback Machines and other things, and there are ways to find it. But the problem is that the amount of information we're losing is far greater. I mean, this is Orwell on steroids. I don't think Orwell ever foresaw a time. You know, they had the Department of Books, which was like editing and destroying all the books. Okay? Well, now they just do it by computer. You know, and they'll take a certain story and trash it, like this one that I'm reading from now, which you'll never see on Facebook, okay, because I can't post it there. But I can read it to you here so you can share the podcast. That's how this works. All right. For example, Australia, well, wasn't this interesting? Funny, we just happened to be writing a Bill of Rights for Australia. You know? And think of the coincidence. That's why we're writing it for Australia, because they've been so badly terrorized and tyrannized by their own government. All right. For example, Australia's first human rights trials of a candidate COVID-19 vaccine was the Novavax, NVX-CoV-2373 in Melbourne by 26th of May 2020. Okay, so Jen Clark is in Melbourne. The person I talked to on this stuff is in Melbourne. And it looks like Shirley's going to let her just a couple minutes here. I want to sort of finish up some of the stuff. It says there is no documentation showing who took part in the trials. The Therapeutic Goods Administration approved the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine on the 25th of January, the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine on the 16th of February, the Janssen vaccine, which is one I don't know about, 25th of June. Phase 1A started on 21st of February 2021, and Phase 1B of the rollout began March 22nd. Now, here's something that people I don't think I've made a connection of that we did fairly early on. This was, about 6 months after it happened. I was thinking about Brian Sicknick. Brian Sicknick's the one that the media all said died of a Trump supporter who whacked him with a fire extinguisher, because we knew that was a lie. And then it came out that he died of natural causes. Well, of course, you know, we have to know what natural causes. Well, the natural causes, they said, were two strokes. I said, oh, really? A perfectly healthy, early 40-year-old man who's in law enforcement where they have physical tests and, you know, all kinds of stuff they test you on a regular basis, suddenly drop dead of two strokes? What would cause that? You know what would cause it. The COVID vaccine. So we did an entire show on why we think Brian Sicknick died of a COVID shot and why that'll never be released. Now, it was January 6th of 2020. Well, how could he die of a COVID shot? They weren't being released yet, but if you remember, they were. Who got the COVID shots first? People on Capitol Hill. Who was in Capitol Hill? The Capitol Hill Police. Who served in the Capitol Hill Police? Brian Sicknick. Connect the dots, folks. This isn't that tough to do. All right. Then they talk about the Philippine trial, and they got some other things here. I'll just sort of put this in my my bank of stories. We're not done with this. I haven't even got to the results. Let me just do the chart real quick. Chart says if you go down to athlete collapses and deaths, 2021, 2022, January of 2021, there were 7 collapses and 4 deaths. January of 2022, 123 collapses and 86 deaths. What does that tell you? And the only difference is the COVID vaccine. Just that simple. All right, let me scroll down here. And what am I looking at? Oh, I forgot to do. Okay, don't mind me. I'm scrolling. I'm looking. I'm having fun. Okay, there we go. All right, I have to bring on Shirley. And my apologies to Shirley because I owe her a theme. I agree with theme, Shirley. I've not made your theme. I'm ridiculously guilty. So let me at least find a little round of applause here to welcome you into the show for this week. That's better. So I got busy. I played guitar for 4 hours yesterday. I'm starting a new band. And I was going to do your theme, but I apologize. I'll get it next week. I will. I mean, I will. Yeah. You're live. Good morning.
No problem. Good morning. You're starting a band? How cool is that?
Well, I've been playing bands for 40 years. You know, I just haven't been good at it. Only a few of them actually got out on stage. You know, this is why I know I have ultimate patience and I'm stubborn. You know, I'm 40 years into an activity. I still haven't had a really successful band on stage. It's like, okay, next one. I got thrown out of my last band by my own band, and that was a band that I started. So like I said, I don't have a really good track record with this.
Wow, you don't?
Yeah.
What's the point of that?
I play a mean guitar. I play a mean guitar. I'll send them.
So they threw you out?
Well, yeah, by email, too. I mean, it's kind of like how people get fired in presidential administrations when they don't have the guts to actually do it in person. So they sent me an email and said, yes, you're no longer in this band. I sent an email back. I created this band. I said, I'll create a better one next time. Good luck.
There you go. Strive for something else.
Yeah, don't get mad. Get even. Move on. Have fun. You know,
there you go.
Exactly. I actually became a better player. So we have an hour. I don't know how much time you have. So if you can give me like a rough approximation, I want to get to your stuff first. And then if you have some more time, we can chat. Do you have an hour before Derek Park gets here?
No, I don't. I'm limited to my half hour session today. I'll be heading off to, I got to get stuff ready to go to the NRA Florida State Conference coming up tomorrow in Orlando.
Ooh. Now, you know what I want you to report on next week, if you could please. I mean, just take notes, take everything, take personalities. I want to know if the NRA is not, you know, all the things the NRA isn't doing that they should be doing, in your opinion. I would be
curious.
Well,
yeah, well, I'm actually speaking, so I don't know how. It's a short little, I'm not really sure. It's the first time event, and apparently they're doing it in various states.
Mm-hmm.
The grassroots portion.
Yeah, they know the gun people don't like them anymore because they're useless. They're geldings.
So
the gelding NRA.
We're going out there and we're speaking. And I think Amanda's got Ohio and various other women have different states that they're going to attend and probably be speakers as well.
Yeah. You can't say girls, but you can say gun girls. I mean, that would have a nice ring to it. We're the gun girls. That's got some possibilities.
Girls, women, ladies.
I know women. Well, you
whatever.
Can say it. I mean, you know.
I can say it.
You can say whatever you want.
I know.
You're independent.
I had a boss that got in trouble with it, and we don't mind being called girls. Yeah.
It's kind of funny.
We don't mind.
You know, I mean, men get called boys all the time. Say, hey, boys, you know, let's go.
It bothers other people, you know. It bothers them more than it bothers the people that concerned with it.
Yeah. So what are you speaking about?
Person.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah.
When?
No. Go ahead. Tell me what you finished that. I'm curious what you're speaking
people
about.
People are offended when it has nothing to do with themselves. They're talking I feel like you're offending person X over here, and that's none of your business. They can speak up for themselves.
So they're being offended for somebody else. Yeah, that's actually kind of fascinating. You can't say that. They might be offended. Okay.
Who was it that was talking about? Was I talking to you about it? The comedian was there was a blind guy in the front row of the show, and he was making. Did we talk about this already?
Nope.
No.
This is new.
Well, he was making making comments, and they're having a good. This guy's laughing up a storm, and And this woman in the back says something about she feels offended that you're picking on the blind person. And he's like, whoa, he seems to be having fun. And he looked at he went to the blind guy and goes, do you know that woman in the back? And he goes, I've never seen her in my life. And he just started packing up. They all started packing up. And he goes, something about other than the fact that he's facing in the wrong direction, we're just having a good old time. So the guy actually...
That's
the blind, I don't know where I read this or something. The blind gentleman said that after the show that most people just ignore him, and he was having a good time. That he was, you know, he was conversing with him, and you know, just like a regular person. So I thought that was funny. She was offended by, and it had nothing to do with her. And that's kind of the way it is today. You know,
no,
people are offended. It has nothing to do with them.
Yeah, people. Oh no, it's like being offended for somebody else. Yeah, I think that is a fascinating phenomenon, you know. And you can actually apply it to gun control because you say, well, you know, you can't have this. Someone else might be bothered by you carrying a gun. Well, that's their problem, you know, their feelings and however they feel about stuff doesn't trump, you know, my right to be able to do something. But this whole phenomenon is fascinating. People, I think they think blind people have to be protected somehow, you know, and they think deaf people are stupid. Well, they're not stupid. They're deaf. There's a difference. They can't hear. You know, and if you ever see someone who's, if you ever watch a group of deaf people with sign language, they're unbelievable. You know, they'll argue faster. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was impressed by that. I actually at one point tried to take sign language class. It's tough. I didn't do very well.
That's because you hear. You were still dependent on your hearing. You know, it'd be interesting if people took sign language, were forced to wear, you know, silencing earplugs or big headsets or things like that. That might make it more interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I never even got through the alphabet. I couldn't remember the alphabet. I had a tough time with that.
Well, it is tough. My daughter took sign language and tried to teach me the alphabet. I actually learned the alphabet in sign language, but that was a while ago. And, you know, what you don't practice, you lose. Which is interesting. Actually, one of the smartest people I've ever known was a friend of mine back in California, and she had, you know, the Helen Keller thing. She was both blind and deaf, and we'd have huge arguments. But the way we did it was, you know, kind of sit at a table, and I'd type out things on a keyboard, and she had a Braille reader, and so she actually had to touch this reader that would pop up the letters. These little dots that would pop up, and she'd read what I was saying, and then scream back at me because she could talk perfectly well. So it's like this one side. So she's yelling. So the blind and deaf person is yelling at me, and the hearing and seeing and talking person is typing. It was hysterical. But that's just how we did it. To us it didn't matter. That's just how we communicated. So that was perfectly normal. So we'd be like at park benches sometimes, and we'd just be talking, and she'd be yelling, and I'd be, you know, and we'd have these just furious debates over all kinds of things, and I'd be typing, and people would be walking by and watching this woman yell at me, you know, what's going on? Well, I can't yell at her because she can't hear me. There's no point. She can't see me either, you know, and we're best friends. So now what do you do? So people's perceptions, and that taught me a lot about perceptions too. You know, and then, you know, and you can relate that to gun stuff, you know, well, you know, like the old perception of women going to gun stores 20 years ago. Well, little lady, come on in here. We'll show you what you need. You know, it's like being at a used car place. Crazy. Perceptions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I know Jim's not going to be on. Did you know about a bill that just came up? HR 6945?
Nope.
About no retaining every gun in a system that restricts your rights act.
6945, yeah. Is that the one?
Yes.
Is that in our gun group? Have we posted the bill there so folks can take a look at it?
No, actually, I just saw it. It was just posted through DC Project, through our form of communication the other day, and I went, oh. So I thought, I'm just going to bring that up
do
real
tell.
Quick.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. Apparently, it was started by Senator Cloud from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, let's see, which part would this act may be cited as the No Retaining Every Gun in the System that Restricts Your Rights Act.
Oh, that's
awful. Within the 90 days after the date of the enactment of this act, the director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives shall destroy all firearm transactions, record records deleted. Delivered to the Attorney General pursuant to Section 923G4 of Title 18, United States Code. Basically destroying the records that they've been hanging on to in I think we talked about that, and they were already digitizing quite a few of them. And then the director of the ATF will submit to Congress a written report that specifies the number of firearm transaction records destroyed. So we'll see how far that goes. I think it had, where does it tell me, 61 co-sponsors. Let's see. I just brought it up onto my computer to see what else we could find out about it.
But I'm bringing it up. It is interesting, but here's the problem, though. Once those records are created, you know they're going to be stuck somewhere. You know they're going to be put away, hidden from Congress. They're going to be thrown. So what I have, and actually I got to talk to Larry Pratt about this. This is back about 4 years ago when I wrote this. So November 19th, 2017, I wrote a bill, the Gun Purchase Background Check Using the Banned List Only Act. So there was no record made whatsoever. And I said, currently, every person who wants to purchase a gun has to go through a background check. The potential is there, despite what the government says, to register everyone into some government database, which is exactly what happened. All right. To remove that possibility and not search citizens without any probable cause, instant checks will be reversed. Instead of checking every customer, each gun retailer and seller will have a list of prohibited persons with photographs in their computer system and a secure government computer program that only they and their staff can use. When a customer wants to make a purchase, their photo ID is compared to the prohibited list. If they are not on the prohibited list, then the purchase goes through. It is up to government to maintain the most current prohibited list. But this way, no government record of the gun purchase is made during the computerized background check, only a check of the purchaser against the prohibited list in the computer. Whether all records of the purchase should be also scrubbed or just kept at the retailer is another consideration. For example, if a gun recovered that was used in a crime, then each retailer in the area or state or nationally could check the serial number against their own records to see who bought that gun, but only that record would be revealed. All the other purchases would still remain the confidential information of the gun retailer. So that was my idea. So you go to a gun shop, you know, you want to buy a gun, you bring a gun to the counter, or they take the counter, or however, well, you bring it to the counter, I guess it's behind the counter usually. So your gun's on the counter. And they say, okay, can I see your government ID? And no problem. Here's my picture ID. Great. Let me take a look. Compare it to the prohibited list. You know, and there's no record made of this. They just look at your driver's license usually and photo and compare it to, you know, see if your name is there. And if your name is there, John Smith, they look through the John Smiths and see if there's if you're the John Smith on the prohibited list. If he ain't there, you know, you buy your gun and out you go. But there's no record made because all they're doing is comparing your driver's license against a computer screen. So nothing's actually entered in the computer that you made the purchase other than what would normally happen at the gun dealer. That's how I would do it.
Well, yeah, and that makes sense because that's normally how they do everything. When they check your ID, well, if they do check your ID when you're voting, you know, do you have a card? Are you mm-hmm. eligible? But I imagine with no fly list, they don't check everybody. They just check the people that are allowed to be flying. Whatever that no-fly list is.
Well, yeah, you're on the no-fly list. Yeah, and that's got problems too. But you're absolutely – that's a great example that they don't check everybody. You don't have to prove you're not on the no-fly list. You know, they have the no-fly list, and they just, you know, see if you're on it. They don't check everybody and do a background check before you fly on an airplane. Exactly. Good point.
Right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
That does make sense. It'd be easier and quicker and, you know, see who's not allowed to. It's kind of like, we can just segue this into the Sacramento mass killing that happened. Did you see recently that they determined that was gun group related? Gang related as a group.
Yeah. We don't talk about the Crips and the Bloods group. Hey, which group do you belong to? Oh, I'm Blood Man.
Yeah, really. So apparently,
that's why I love live radio.
They're not going to tell you it's, you know, gang related, but they just found out it is gang related, which a lot of the mass killings are gang related, I believe.
Oh yeah, Chicago.
And the fact that one of these
people
was prohibited to have a firearm and he possessed it. How did that happen?
Wait a minute. There's gun control. That's supposed to stop that. I mean, you know, as we say, gun control only prevents the law-abiding from defending themselves. That's gun control.
Exactly.
It is.
Right.
It's always been that. That's the whole purpose. You know, you look at the racist roots of gun control, and that's actually an article, a big one, you know, about how free black slaves were immediately, you know, lost gun rights, which of course is unconstitutional, but they didn't care back then, you know. And the same thing, I think the Irish in Boston, you know, another victimized group, and Native Americans, another victimized group. You know, none of those folks could own guns. You know, so it's a fascinating study of guns is really the study of freedom. You know, you look at, and it goes to any country, you know, most countries don't have any ability to own guns. I think Switzerland and Israel are the only ones other than us that have anything close to a Second Amendment. You know, it's quite a fascinating thing to go through all and study all this kind of stuff. But I post that bill to your messenger. I put it in the Action Radio Gun Group. Action Radio Gun Group is public. Anybody can go there and take a look. But it's very simple. You know, it's a reverse background check. So in other words, you know, this is the prohibited list that's being checked, not you. As long as you're not on the prohibited list, buy what you want right then and there. You know, and if you wait, what do you
think that would be easier and take less time for, you know, resources? I would say so.
It'll probably take about 30 seconds. You know, for my name, Greg Penglis, I mean, there's only one of me. You know, they wouldn't even have another Greg Penglis out there. So I'd be the easiest person to check. The common names would be tougher. That would take a little longer. If you had to go through John Smith's, you might be there a while. You know, but other than that, but that's not, you know, John Smith's problem or Jane Smith, you know, it's up to this is why the burden should always be on the government. You know, it's not what you have to hide. It's what the government has to prove. And so your privacy is your right. And, you know, the fact that they're actually doing a warrantless search. Every time a background check is done, that really is a warrantless search, which technically is unconstitutional. Well, I mean, not technically, it is unconstitutional. So that's a way you could challenge it.
A warrantless search. Okay.
Ooh, see all the fun we have. Do you have your notepad?
There you go. Another tidbit of information. The warrantless search.
Background checks are a warrantless search. Well, that comes from our. I'm doing this incredible work with Jen Clark in Australia on the Australian Bill of Rights. And one of the things we did was we took our Fourth Amendment, which says no unreasonable searches. And I looked it up. I said, what makes a search unreasonable? Well, there's no warrant. Most people don't know that. They think of unreasonable being some kind of quality, like, well, it was reasonable to search you, or it wasn't reasonable to search you based on, you know, some kind of arbitrary criteria. What unreasonable really meant in back in the 1700s was no warrant. So when I wrote that particular part of the Australian Bill of Individual Rights, when we say individual rights, everybody knows it's individual, not group, not collective, not anything else. We made it very clear that instead of saying unreasonable searches and seizures, we say warrantless searches and seizures to make it stronger and more up to date. You're going to love that when it comes out. You folks in DC Project are going to go crazy. You're going to read all this stuff and go, oh, my God, this is great. At least I hope so. Back to you. Are you still there? Hello, Charlie.
I'm here.
Okay, good. And I worry because I've had the show just drop out. I've it'll do that. It doesn't do that much anymore, but there are times when it's just cut me off from my own show, and I have no idea that I've been cut off. So, wait a minute, where's everybody?
Seriously.
So, yeah.
You cut yourself off?
No, they did. Blog Talk did. Well, I've done it too. I actually ended the show by mistake a couple times. So, you know, That's really embarrassing. Yeah. So tell me about what do you think about NRA in Florida? And is this Florida NRA or is this national NRA thing you're going to?
Well, it's called the Florida State Conference.
Okay.
They have representative in each state, and that's who's heading this up. I really don't know what to expect, or you know, this is the first time they're doing it, so. Yeah, I was invited to talk about DC Project, so I'll be talking about DC Project as well as touching a little tidbit about my book. And then
which is? Go ahead
and
name it. Name your book.
Oh,
let's hear
my
it.
My book, Heels to Holster. You can purchase it on Amazon.
Yep.
But, yeah, we're going to be doing a Q&A, I guess. It's not real long. I think from 10 to 2 or 9 to 1, something like that. And they have a few different speakers. So, you know, it'd be interesting to hear what they have to say about what's been going on. I don't know how many people they plan on 100 to 150 people attending, but you never know with the first time event. So it'd be interesting to see who shows up and find out what's going on in the NRA and maybe get some answers to questions like Jim was bringing up about concealed carry in Florida. I mean, the constitutional carry.
Well, that was my question too. Yeah. You know, I want to know that as well. You know, the NRA should be 100% behind this. There should be massive ads, you know, in Tallahassee, you know, or in key legislative districts. You know, are you going to comply with the Constitution, or are you going to keep violating our rights? You know, I mean, something like this, a big bold statement like that, and then have, you know, big, you know, bold letters, constitutional carry in big quotation marks. You know, and they'll have like a mom with, you know, a stroller and some kids and openly carrying her gun. You know, we got to use the propaganda whenever we can. But yeah, that'd be kind of a cool thing to do. Big billboards.
Yeah, so,
but the NRA's got the money. Well, they've got the money to do this kind of stuff, and they don't do it.
And I don't know if they've done it in other states. That's another question. Are you backing it in other states and just chose not to do it in Florida, or what's the deal? So I don't know.
Good question.
It'll be an experience to find out what's been going on, because we haven't had an NRA annual meeting for, what, 2 years? 3 years? 2 years?
I don't know. I left the NRA about 10 years ago, at least, you know, because they're like the Republicans, they're geldings. They don't do anything. They're fundraisers. And I have no use for people that want to raise money and not do anything. They don't use the Second Amendment in court. Well, occasionally, but they don't, you know, they'll take the Heller decision and go, oh, this is a great deal. Reasonable restrictions. Yeah, we can live with that. Screw you. I don't want to live with reasonable restrictions. That's unconstitutional. There are no restrictions on rights as long as you're within the right. People are going, what are you talking about, Greg? Well, it's very simple. The Second Amendment, you know, I'm channeling Rush Limbaugh, but Greg, you know, and I explain this to folks all the time. And you know, you might want to use this too, that, and this is one of our Australian Bill of Rights rights. The first three of our Australian Bill of Rights, since there's 30 of them, this is an amazingly comprehensive thing. We've got digital tracking. We've got 5G technology. We've got social credits. We've got all this kind of stuff. It's an amazing document. Anyway, but one of the things, that we talk about now, completely. I get thinking of other trains of thought. My mind just wanders really fast. But where was it going? I totally forgot where I was going with this. I hate when that happens. Oh, ADHD brain. What was I just talking about? I'll get to it back. Oh, Australian Bill of Rights was oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Here we go. Okay, I'm back. Folks, listen, when you have 15 things in your head at the same time, you think this is easy? You don't want to live in my brain. It's a very strange place to operate. I have enough trouble. And it's just, anyway. So context of the right is critical to people understanding how rights work. So our right number two, all rights are absolute within the context of the right. So the Second Amendment, what's the context of the Second Amendment? To keep and bear, which means to own and carry. Okay. Does that mean you can use it in any way you want? No. Your use of firearms is outside the Second Amendment. It's outside the context, because how you use it could be legal or illegal. So there's no right. The right does not extend to how you use it. That's governed by law, and it has to be, because there are things like murder and things like target shooting, one of which is illegal and the other is legal. So because there's a legal and illegal distinction, you can't have it be a right, because if you cross over legal or illegal in your use, then it's not absolute. And if it's not absolute, it can't be counted as a right. So the absolute right is to keep and bear. So when people say, well, we got to stop criminals, I say, fine, you can stop criminals all you want, but that's outside the Second Amendment. It's outside the context of law-abiding citizens keeping and bearing or owning and carrying firearms. Make sense?
It does. It makes perfect sense.
Okay.
That's a good way to explain it. They kind of try to lump everything in one basket there, so that once again they can start controlling us and taking away firearms.
But if you want to adopt that argument and just kind of work it through, it took me a while. I mean, most of my arguments that sound really good have gone through a multi-year evolutionary process. Okay, it doesn't just happen that I can just explain things like that. But this is, it's kind of a theory I had that rights, you know, well, rights are when they talk about reasonable restrictions. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, how do we get around this whole stupid idea of reasonable restrictions? And I said, rights are absolute. Well, really, you can walk around with an A-bomb? No, because I wouldn't consider that arms. You know, first of all, it takes more than one person to do it. And if it takes more than one person, it's not an individual right, because all individual rights have to be able to be expressed individually. So the arms are what you can carry, although some people have argued that a privately owned battleship is covered under the Second Amendment. I would tend to question that, even though people had their own. Yeah, that gets a little crazy. Well, no, people were privately owned ships. In fact, the government, I think, you know, paid for frigates during the War of 1812. Because we didn't have a navy, but, you know, people had private ships that were fully armed and, you know, excuse me, pirates and all that kind of stuff. So that it gets kind of weird. But the point is, the arms usually refers to things that you can carry in your arms. That's what it means to be armed. swords, knives, guns, things like that. Fully automatic, you know, a machine gun, a fully automatic rifle is completely covered under the Second Amendment because it's arms. It's something you can carry individually. And as long as you're keeping and bearing it, you're within the context of the right. And if you have an absolute right, you know, within the context to keep and bear any arm, then that's legal. That's the constitutional. All right. Now, can you use it any way you want? No. I mean, you can use a two-shot Derringer illegally and keep and bear a fully automatic machine gun with a 100-round drum on it legally. I mean, there's a way to explain it. Make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
It does.
Yeah.
Just to bring up, wow, it's all right. Time flies when I'm talking with you. Just to bring up,
that's because I talk too much.
There's something else. Another bill that came up, I just saw a post from Diana, founder of DC Project, and it originated with Congressman Thomas Massie, and it's a bill to repeal Federal Gun-Free School Zones Act.
Oh, I love it. Yes, fine.
So, yeah, that's something that just popped up on my old radar right now, so I figured, well, might as well bring it up.
Absolutely, yeah.
Let's see, gun-free zones are ineffective and make our schools less safe. Since 1950, 98% of the mass public shootings have occurred in places where citizens are banned from having guns. That was Representative Massie. Banks, churches, sports stadiums, and many of my colleagues in Congress are protected with firearms, yet the children inside the classroom are too frequently left vulnerable. The only thing gun-free zones do is just arm law-abiding citizens and take away their ability to protect themselves and others. We shouldn't leave our most vulnerable, our children, in an unsafe environment like gun-free zones where acts of violence cannot be stopped. That was quoted by Representative Jeff Duncan from South Carolina. Let's see, what else information do we have here? Gun Owners of America is proud to support Thomas Massie. And gun-free zones are a lie, said Dudley Brown, president of the National Association of Gun Rights. It doesn't make guns magically disappear. They only make criminals out of the people who would protect our children.
Okay. So what would you call them? If you could change the language and make it an accurate description of what these things are, instead of a gun-free zone, what would you call them?
We discussed this, how you reverse that around. I'm not so good at that. Gun-free zone would be, instead of making it, you're making it, I don't know.
Oh, come on, try it.
No.
Go ahead. Unfreedom? Yeah, you're on the, go ahead. Keep going. You're getting there. I'm doing this for a reason. A, it's fun. I'm enjoying myself thoroughly. But B, the fact that that you're thinking immediately, how can I rephrase that? How can I put that in correct language? Is something that is critical to. We talked about this. How you can control the debate by changing the language.
Yeah.
Did you ever get my conservative glossary? Did you get my conservative glossary that I sent you?
I did.
Yeah.
I read
you
that.
Like those?
Then the
yeah.
Okay, help me out here. I'm kind of like stumped now.
It takes me time to think of these too. You know, I'm just curious to watch someone else go through the process.
You've got so many voices in your head; they're all helping you out.
Yeah, that's why I wouldn't quite phrase it "voices in my head" because you know, people. I have thoughts in my head. Let's go with that. But if you're quoted, Shirley Watchell says that Greg Pringle says voices in his head, talking to him all the time. Oh, great. This is going to be a real short show. Thanks, Shirley.
Oh, okay.
Here's one for you.
So many multiple thoughts going on at one time.
Yeah, that sounds much better. Thank you. Now I'm happy. Okay, good.
You're like a genius with all them thoughts flying around there at one time.
Wow. Nah, I wouldn't go that far. That sounds arrogant, but thank you very much. You can say it. I appreciate it. Yeah. How about victim disarmament zone?
Yeah.
Let's see if we can. That's in my glossary. Let's see if we can think of a better one. I think I would. I think I wrote an article. We should convert gun free zones to gun freedom zones.
Oh, that was it. That was it.
Yeah. So we don't want gun free zones because those are victim disarmament zones. Those are you know, terrorist encouragement zones. I just thought of that one. Well, you're creating a terrorist encouragement zone? You know, that's what you take away the guns. You're encouraging terrorists. What kind of person are you, liberal gun phobe? you know, use gun fob a lot.
Because you know when you throw terrorist and that word in there, that mean, that mm-hmm. that all of a sudden people go, what?
Yeah.
Gets attention.
This is a terrorist encouragement zone. Why? Because it's a victim disarmament zone. Why? Because some gun phobe thought they were exercising gun control, which is unconstitutional. They're taking your rights away so that someone else can take your life away. Ooh. Oh, yeah. Use that. That was good. get the podcast. This is why I love talking to you. I don't know why, but you inspire a lot of creativity in me. And this is quite, you do. I don't know how. It's just great. This is, you know, you're like the perfect person to work with on this kind of language stuff.
It's amazing though when you talk like that, when you talk about words and what thoughts mm-hmm. that automatically come to people's minds because they're so conditioned on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And like I said, you have to think about it. Okay, what can I say instead of a gun-free zone? What is it actually? Yeah. It's you can just simplify it to as a victim zone. You're allowing people to become victimized.
Yeah. You can call it the violence prone zone. Violence prone zone. Ooh, yeah.
Oh, that's
it rhymes at least.
Say that fast a few times, though.
It's kind of tough. But I think things are easier to say. But the problem is that the left usually has better, shorter, snappier sayings. My problem is that the things I think of are usually a little bit long. You know, gun-free zone is a very simple, straightforward. They must have computers or algorithms or, you know, in their pajamas in their mother's basement, you know, writing these things. And with nothing better to do, some really good ones. I forget. And because
it's,
conservatives...
It's that marketing. You
know, hmm?
It's that marketing thing they have. You know, someone just sitting down there, just sitting about, thinking about how to rephrase things and make them quick and catchy so everybody starts saying those.
Mm-hmm.
Phrases.
Well, and sometimes we do, like, I love the expression gun phobe. Are you a gun phobe? Do you have a pathological fear of guns? What's your problem? So whatever you do, you want to put the problem on the leftist, the person that wants to control you. You know, and, you know, like if someone, this might actually work. Someone says, well, why do you need an assault weapon? You know, other than the fact that, so first of all, it's a freedom rifle, and why do you need to control me? What's your problem? You know, throw it right back on them. Why do you need to control everyone? Who are you anyway? Are you that good? You know, you know, I mean, you can have fun with this. All right, now, is your speech going to be videoed?
I don't know. I said, I'm kind of just going to find out what's happening.
Nah, we need. I want to see this. We need a video. Do you need a friend with a? Do you have like a tripod for your cell phone?
No,
$20. Order one online. Get a friend to you know, set up a cell phone. You know,
find somebody.
Get a video.
Take care of
them. Yeah, come on. It's going to be great. You want to keep a record of these things.
Oh, yeah. You're right. That's one thing, though, when you go to Ambassador Academy, which mm-hmm. you learn about all this stuff and how to handle yourself and how to answer tough questions and hostile interviews. But they always say you have to watch yourself after your interviews or listen to yourself. And it's like, oh, you don't want to because it just never turns out the way you always – where it goes in your head beforehand and how it comes out are never the same.
Listen, I'm alive on radio. I hear that every day. when I listen to my podcast, you know, which I do sometimes, you know, sometimes whole shows, but a lot of times I'll listen to particular parts of it. Like my monologues I like to listen to see if I'm making any sense whatsoever. And I listen to them. Usually they actually turn out better than I think they do. And so, you know, I think I'll totally screw up something and I'll be incoherent and I'll listen to it and go, oh, that wasn't so bad. You know, so do you ever listen to your reports that you do on this show?
No, I have not. You told me last time I should listen to them.
You
and you know, it's
should.
Kind of like, this, like we're kind of talking about reversing the phrases and what, like gun-free zones and stuff like that. I should do that. I should think of it as, oh, I might have done better than I thought and listen to them and go, oh, okay.
Absolutely.
Instead of thinking, oh, yeah. I always do worse.
No, you're really good on this show. I mean, you're really good. For someone that doesn't have a lot of, you know, radio experience, as they say, and, you know, broadcast experience, you know, I don't think any of our folks do. You know, I didn't go to school. I don't have a communications or a journalism or a broadcasting degree or anything like that. I just wanted to do it. You know, I've got 6 months of, you know, junior college producing, you know, stuff so I can make all the things that I make here on the show. But that's it. You know, I just said, I can do this. You know, I just went with it. You know, I'm not a lawyer, but I write legislation. You know, I'm not a psychologist. You know, I analyze everybody. So you're good at this, and you should definitely listen to it and get used to the sound of your own voice, hearing your own voice back. You're not alone. I think most people do not listen. Most people, they don't. The sound of their own voice is like, who's that? you know, some kind of weird thing. You know, and I can explain it because what you hear in your head has the vibration of your skull and bones and mastoid bone in your ear, and it sounds different. You know, when you hear it through a speaker, it's just the air sound, not the full sound of the function. And so that's why your voice sounds different. Little tidbit to no one's help. Yeah. I don't know where I get these things from. It's part of the ADHD. It's all in my head. All this weird stuff comes out. But once you get used to the sound of your own voice, and it does take time. It's not something that happens, you know, on your first listening, because first listening, you think you sound weird. And you're not even listening to what you're saying. You're just realizing how weird you sound. Once you get over that, then you can kind of go and actually listen to what you say. And what you realize very quickly, I think, as a lot of us do, that it's not as bad as you thought it was. It's actually pretty good. And it's kind of fun. And so that's a process. Just, you know, you'll see.
Yeah.
Trust me.
I'll have to do that. I'll do that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. You don't believe me.
I believe you. I do believe you. I just don't know when you're going to do it. I know you're going to
do it. Sometime.
Yeah, sometime. Oh. When you're driving out to your NRA convention, just line up a couple of browser windows with Friday reports and just queue it all up so that you can you know, immediately go to it or something like that. Yeah, you know, you'll figure it out. Listen to my monologues. Listen to my monologue before we get to your report. It's only half an hour. You know, you can probably get a couple of those in on a drive. Yeah. Okay. We have more time because I have issues for you if you have more time. There's more stuff we can talk about. Or do you have to
actually, I need to get going.
Okay.
But
let's hear your book again.
It's always been fun. Yeah. My book is Heels to Holster. Mm-hmm. It's available on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And it's about my surviving domestic violence and how I claim my life back by exercising my Second Amendment rights. And I'm now the Florida State Director for DC Project. DC Project is Women for Gun Rights. We're a national group of women that are working to preserve and defend our Second Amendment. We are nonpartisan. We are women from all different walks of life, race, religions, all different types. But we have one thing in common. We support and defend our Second Amendment. If you want more information on that, you can go to dcproject.info. And this is Shirley Watcher reporting with Action Radio from the DC Project, the Women in Gun Rights segment.
I told you, you're so good at this. Now, what I'd like to do, either this is fun, either in this half hour or if you want an hour, I'd love to talk about your book for in great detail. And so let's do that sometime. Like I say, if you want to do a separate hour during the week, if you have an hour when you can do it, that'd be great. Or if you like, it started at 6 o'clock. It would be 7 o'clock your time, 7 o'clock Eastern. You know, because I know 8 o'clock life gets busy. I'm perfectly willing to do that. We can pick a day, or you can just do it, you know, on the show here for half an hour. If we have an hour, like we do, because Jim's off, you know, once a month, and so this is that day for this month. If you can do the time, if you have the time to spend on it, I'd love to do that, just to hear all about the book, and that'd be your story too. So you know, much as you want to share, that'd be fascinating.
I think also what I might try and do is, since Jim's off on the second week of every month, I might try to get my, like we talked about, someone I'm going to be interviewing or talk about my story, something like that for that time.
Yeah.
I'll try to free up an hour for that. This just happened to be a busy day today. But,
no, that's fine.
It's been great, as always.
Yeah, so, and thank you. It is, like I say, you know, the more you do this, the better you're getting at it. And it's great to have you on the show because, like I say, you inspire my creativity. It's really quite fascinating. So I'm having a great time doing it.
It's really good stuff, I must say. Yeah. I'm like, wow, I got to write that down.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of podcasts. You know, so you can go back. So when you listen to your podcasts with your notepad, you know, you can stop it and go, I want to hear that again. That was great. And you can write stuff down and away you go. Yeah. All right, Shirley. Get out of here. Get your work done. Have a great week, and I'll see you. I'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Bye now. One of my favorite people. I can't help it. I love having Shirley on. And like I say, it's to be able to work with someone and come up with all these different expressions and things like that is really wonderful. All right. I'm going to take a little bit of time now. I'm going to play my new Santa Rosa Volunteers piece, which is on Anti-Federalist number 10. And we'll have some time after that. Derek Park joins us at the bottom of the hour. We're going to talk money. Yeah, it's not like nothing's going on in money. And then we have, let me see, take us to 8 o'clock Central Time. Donnie Chapman, I'm not sure how long Donnie's going to be with us. He usually does competitions right now, so he may not have a lot of time. But we can get back to our main topic. which I pretty much covered in the first half hour, but however much time we have in the last hour, everybody's welcome to join in and talk about the COVID deaths that aren't being reported, the fact that they've watched some athletics special and somebody tragically died right there on the field. You know, this is happening. It's happening right now. And so I'll have a little bit of time after this before Derek gets here. I'll see if I can finish up more of the article. But if I don't do this now, there's no guarantees I ever will for the rest of the show. So anti-federalist number 10. And I will be back after this presentation. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments. Insights into our founding documents. Sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Preceding Karl Marx by 100 years or more, we have in Anti-Federalist Number 10, probably the first class analysis of politics. The author, A. Farmer, whom we've heard from before, got Anti-Federalist Number 10 published on March 18, 1788, in two Maryland newspapers. A. Farmer introduces the concept of parties, or classes, of individuals to whom want power. He says this: as our citizens are now apprised of the progress of parties or political opinions on the continent, it is fit they should also be informed of the present state, force and designs of each, in order that they may form their decisions with safety to the public and themselves. This shall be given with all the precision and impartiality the author is capable of. America is at present divided into three classes or descriptions of men, and in a few years there will be but two. It's interesting to note that the founders were very much against political parties. They believed our greatest danger was a Congress divided into factions, what we today call the Democrats and Republicans. George Washington, in his farewell address, said this: political parties serve to organize a faction, to give it an artificial and extraordinary force, to put, in the place of the delegated will of the nation, the will of the party, often a small but artful and enterprising minority of the community, and, according to all, to the alternate triumphs of different parties, to make the public administration the mirror of the ill-concerted and incongruous projects of faction, rather than the organ of consistent and wholesome plans digested by common councils and modified by mutual interests. A. Farmer begins his political class analysis with this: the first class comprehends all those men of fortune and reputation who stepped forward in the late revolution, from opposition to the administration, rather than the government of Great Britain. All those aristocrats whose pride disdains equal law, many men of very large fortune who entertain real or imaginary fears for the security of property. They are at present wavering. They are generally, though with very many exceptions, openly for the proposed, but secretly against any American government. A burnt child dreads the fire, but should they see any fair prospect of confusion arise, these gentry will be off at any moment for these 25 years to come. Finally, this class contains more aggregate wisdom and moral virtue than both the other two together. It commands nearly 2/3 of the property and almost 1/2 the numbers of America, and has at present become almost irresistible from the name of the truly great and amiable man who, it has been said, is disposed to patronize it, and from the influence which it has over the second class. Pretty good analysis. Then A. Farmer continues with this: the second class is composed of those descriptions of men who are certainly more numerous with us than in any other part of the globe. We have a vast overproportion of these great men who, when you tell them that from the earliest period at which mankind devoted their attention to social happiness, it has been their uniform judgment that a government over governments cannot exist, That is two governments operating on the same individual assume the smile of confidence and tell you of two people traveling the same road, of a perfect and precise division of the duties of the individual. Still, however, the political apophthegm is as old as the proverb that no man can serve two masters, and whoever will run their noddles against old proverbs will be sure to break them, however hard they may be. As the second class never can include any of the yeomanry of the Union, who never affect superior wisdom and can have no interest but the public good, it can be only said to exist at the birth of government. And as soon as the first and third classes become more decided in their views, this will divide with each and dissipate like a mist, or sink down into what are called moderate men, and become the tools and instruments of others. These people are prevented by a cloud from having any view, and if they are not virtuous, they at least preserve the appearance, which in this world amounts to the same thing. A. Farmer then reveals the third class. He says, in this third class may be counted men of the greatest mental powers and of as sublime virtue as any in America. They at present command nearly one-third of the property and above half the numbers of the United States. And in either event, they must continue to increase in influence by great desertions from both the other classes. If the proposed government is not adopted, theirs will be the prevalent opinion. The object of this class either is or will be purely federal, a union of independent states, not a government of individuals. The proposed government A. Farmer is addressing is one under the new Constitution, which the Federalists are attempting to ratify. It also appears that words like faction and party are used interchangeably but mean different things. In this final statement by A. Farmer, I believe his use of one party implies one big national government, which rules over the many other parties, which are the individual states. That is the goal of the Federalists, one Federalists, one party rule, despite their great efforts to hide this. Whereas the goal of the anti-Federalists is a government of the states, united, who have delegated very limited powers to and are supreme over the federal government, and where the states are preserved as multiple parties, sovereign, balanced, and together they regulate any abuse of powers by the federal government. Consider carefully this final statement by A. Farmer. Learn this most difficult and necessary lesson, that on the preservation of parties, public liberty depends. Whether men are unanimous on great public questions, whenever there is but one party, freedom ceases and despotism commences. The object of a free and wise people should be so to balance parties, that from the weakness of all you may be governed by the moderation of the combined judgments of the whole, not tyrannized over by the blind passions of a few individuals. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. Cool. All right, we're back. It's what time is it? Almost 20 minutes, 19 minutes past the hour here. I don't know why I give time checks, because most of you listen on podcasts, but it seems a thing to do. I don't know. It's a radio thing. So I had a very interesting time making that particular podcast. I'm always fascinated with the anti-federalists, a lot more than the federalists. And so I'll be working on Federalist Papers number 11 and hopefully anti-federalist number 11 as well next week. I got behind during the course of the writing of the Australian Bill of Individual Rights, because that was just such an amazing project. I know I keep saying that, and you're probably tired of hearing it, and I'm sorry. I think you're going to find it, though, when we actually get to present this, that this is every bit, this will live up to you know, all my hype right now. We've got a little extra time. I just found out that Derek won't be able to join us for the financial report, so I've got our bill on financial reform and financial accountability. I'll be going over that. So the lines are open, 215-383-3832. It's Friday. It's kind of catch-up day. Donnie Chapman, Chappie's going to join us at 8 o'clock, so the top of the hour, and give us a pretty quick report because he's competing, so he's busy too. So really, we've got a lot of the rest of the show open. I love talking to Shirley. Actually, our Friday lineup, when it goes – you know, when everybody's able to participate, you know, you get Alan Dawson at the start of the show, and then Shirley Wachow, you know, half an hour later, and then Jim Dykes half an hour later, and then Derek Park half an hour later, and then Donnie Chapman after that. And I usually get about, 15, 20 minutes of my own to do the show. That's when everybody's here. Because Friday's a kind of catch-up day, and it's almost never that everybody's here. I think it's only happened maybe once or twice. So this is why I don't mind having all these folks scheduled, because chances are someone on a Friday is going to, it's going to be kind of off doing other stuff. All right, so let me hold off on that bill for now, the financial accountability one, and let's get back to our athletic bill. Our athletic study. So I started the show with this article in Real Science. Science needs open discussion. Anything else is totalitarianism. And the article is 833 athletic cardiac arrests, serious issues, and 540 dead. And this is after the COVID shot. And the website is goodscience.com/COVID/athletes suffer cardiac arrest die after COVID shot. So there's your – well, just go to goodscience.com COVID. This will show up. It won't be too hard to find. So I got that one. I got military. I read about the military. I read about good science. Dates of first vaccinations. I think I covered that. Clubs hide vaccination information, definite proof of vaccination. Let's go back and see where I covered. I don't know. I mean, let's say it was the beginning of the show. I remember reading this one. Okay, so let's start at this headline here. Clubs hide vaccination information now. Here's a demonstration of how sports clubs do not want the injuries or of deaths of their players to be associated with the COVID vaccines. It tells the story of why they will not report which of their players have been vaccinated and when. Sunderland FC, I think that's probably a rugby club, manager Lee Johnson suggested that the COVID vaccines may have caused the heart issues for his goalkeeper, Lee Burge. That's B-U-R-G-E. The club then sacked the manager. So there you go. So you talk about COVID, you're going to get fired. If you speculate that one of your players died of a COVID shot, this is what happened. This guy got fired, right? It says, form your own conclusions as to why the club would sack a manager who cares about his players. Well, they don't see it that way because, like this article says earlier, this is about money. COVID's always been about money. COVID's a marketing scheme. First, they come up with the messenger RNA snake oil jab, and to sell it, they label it a vaccine, but it's not. You know, they create COVID, after they create the vaccine so that they have a marketing, they have a terror device to scare the hell out of everybody to market the vaccine, which is not a vaccine. You see how this works? Yeah, Moderna was created in 2010 for the sole purpose of creating messenger RNA jabs. So you tell me, COVID came out what, in 2019? 9 years later, okay, engineered specifically to this jab. You tell me which came first, right? Anyway, definite proof of vaccination. So here we go back to this. If you just joined the show now and you're wondering where I started this, go back to the beginning, catch the podcast. All right, definite proof of vaccination. Article says the so-called fact checkers are trying to say that because we don't always have definite proof of vaccination, then 100% of the data we're collecting is worthless. Well, good news. Fact checkers, you are not only wrong, you are idiots. I love an article that just states that so boldly. It says, while historically there have been a relatively small number of athlete deaths each year that weren't from old age or cancer, there has never been anything like what's happening since the COVID vaccination trial started. And they know it, but they don't care. We will continue to gather as much information as possible about every person who dies. These are real people, not just numbers. Yeah, that's the thing too. These are not numbers. These are not numbers. These are people. And if you care about people, if you care about human life, if you care about life, then you care about this issue. All right. There we go. As we said elsewhere, this is back to the article, we're collecting data. Other people can use this data and add to it, if they can, to research whatever they want. We won't be distracted from that, even if families, clubs, governments, and the media hide information from us. We don't want to hurt families, but families can't hide real data because that could harm other people. According to governments, 90 to 95% of populations all over the world are now vaccinated. Damn, that's the scariest thing I've heard in a long time. So the fact checkers have a problem. If that is true, then just about everyone is vaccinated. If it isn't true, then governments are lying, possibly for the purpose of coercing those who don't want their vaccinations for various reasons. We will publish as much data as we can find, and from time to time, we and readers will discover information that wasn't found earlier, and it will be added. Now remember, this is a site that I can't put on Facebook. Okay, I cannot put this article on Facebook because I'll get kicked off, and if I get kicked off, I can't do my good work. Okay, somebody says, not good work, Greg. You're lying to yourself. No, I think we're doing pretty good work here. Anyway, but that's why I can't post it. But like I said, this thing is fascinating. Hate mail and death threats gets better. As well as receiving new cases and updates from alert readers, we are also receiving hate mail and death threats, death wishes. Haters need to get a life. Suffering these adverse reactions and deaths didn't ask for this. Neither did the tens of thousands of other people. They all thought they were doing the right thing. Well, that's the first mistake. The government tells you what the right thing to do is, you got to immediately question that. All right. Back to the article. Many were coerced into getting the vaccinations. When one of these adverse events happens to you or one of your kids or relatives, you'd be glad we're collecting all this data. If you are one of the haters who thinks vaccination is the way out of this nightmare, read the story about three young women whose lives have been destroyed by the vaccine. Maybe I'll click on that one a little bit later. I mean, I'll click on it now. Let's see if I want to cover this now. We got time. We got lots of time. I got too much time. There's more time than I expected today to do the show, you know, for just me talking. And I get really bored just me talking. So there's a good chance I'll be playing other things or doing stuff if folks don't know me. MSM gaslighting. More women share their stories via social media. All right. I'm going to keep this. I'm going to copy this because I've heard if I have too many browser windows, my computer gets upset. And so let's add this article over here. And another story. I'll probably post this one on Facebook. Let's click that. Yeah, I got my left hand on the keyboard, right hand on the mouse. I'm talking. I'm doing all this at the same time. I don't know how I'm doing all this at the same time, but it is kind of interesting. All right, so let's get back to our main article. Scroll, and let's see where we ended up. Definite proof of vaccination. There we go. All right. So that's the fascinating thing. If 90 to 95% of the people are vaccinated, you would think that COVID would be gone. If COVID's not gone, then the vaccines aren't working. And if you look around, I remember working with a company where the only people who caught COVID were wearing masks. Go figure. I didn't wear a mask. I didn't catch it. So go figure, right? If you look around at the politicians, who is getting COVID these days? Nancy Pelosi, Jen Psaki, you know, other folks. Obama, liberals who believe in mandates, who wear masks, are getting COVID. Well, what does that tell you? And that's just anecdotal evidence, right? So this is all quite fascinating. All right. The hate mail would cover that. Recent changes. Here we go. More stuff. Recent. You try talking for 3 hours sometimes. It's not easy. So like I say, I'm going to play some more stuff if folks aren't joining me. Recent changes. Update 2022, 17th of March to April 2nd. These are people who have died. Thomas Rankin, Karuki Moncrief, Sharad Kumar, Jeffrey Klumpkins, Ya Hui, Steven Spitzer, Steve Black. There's like 30 more names I'm not going to read right now, but that's the recent. Those are people that have died recently, and there's a whole listing of them here. So these people, I name names, okay? So they name names. If I wanted to name people I think died of the COVID shot, Colin Powell, Marvin Hagler, Hank Aaron, Larry King. Who's the guy from Full House? The comedian, you know, him. Who else died of it? Those are the main people I can think of. Betty White, Brian Sicknick. You know, the list goes on. You know, there's a lot of actors and actresses that aren't, you know, the A-list, aren't the superstars that have died, that did what they thought was the right thing to do. So then they go, next section here, where are the fact checkers? Readers are writing us to ask, writing to us asking for comparisons from previous years. Some say without that, these results mean nothing. That's not true, because if we had seen this in previous years, it would be well known and others would have documented. We're starting to work on this. It is a lot of work. Where are the fact checkers? Where is the mainstream media? Some have piles of money from Bill Gates, Some have piled money from Bill Gates. There we go. Why are they not proving us wrong by all piling on and showing the documented athlete deaths from 2019, 2018, and 2017 and the previous decade? They are nowhere to be found because this number of athlete deaths is abnormal and they know it. They have money from people who don't want journalists poking around, so that's why they don't try to thoroughly fact-check these reports or show previous year's numbers. Follow this link. We got the Gates Foundation handout. So there we go, to some media that could do it. There you go. For example, NPR in the USA receives $24 million from the Gates Foundation. Let's check that one out, too. Let's see what the Gates Foundation is doing. You know, open the gates to your money. Open your gates to the Gates Foundation. Here we go. Reveal show Bill Gates has given $319 million to media outlets. Well, there you go. How do you trust the media outlet getting money from Bill Gates, from his foundation? All right, so let's add this to this. Shifting through over 30,000 grants in the company's database, Mint Press can reveal that the Gates Foundation has bankrolled hundreds of media outlets and ventures to the tune of at least $319 million. Article by Alan McLeod. In the website, MPN News, I have no idea who they are, but I'm going to copy this article, do what I do best, add it to my list, my growing list. This is the first show I've actually gotten more information as the show went on, because I keep finding links, and this is such a good article. It's too bad I can't post it, but, you know, that's the way things go in a tyrannically censored nation. Well, it's what you want. You know, they had a coup. The geldings allowed the coup to succeed. And here we are, you know, doing shows with articles we can't post. It's a fascinating thing that where we've all ended up here. I'm not sure how, but that's where we are. All right. Let's quick check here. Get back to my article. Hopefully they click the right buttons here. All right. So where are the fact checks? We covered that. They're nowhere to be found. Pull this link. Here we go. The Gates Foundation also funded many investigative journalism centers with around $38 million. Well, that's interesting in itself. If any journalist investigative journalism center is taking money from the Gates Foundation, I would question everything they write. Could that be why journalistic curiosity suddenly stopped being a fang? Yeah. Where are you journalists out there? Where's your curiosity? Where's your curiosity about anything? You know, this is one thing the show does, you know, above everything else, is ask questions. We don't have answers to everything. We're still busy asking the questions. Anyway, a few weak attempts of debunking this data has started to come out, but they cherry pick a small number of the entries. Yeah. And here's the chart again. This is a great chart. Again, January of 2021, you know, just as the I guess the vax was emerging on the scene, 7 collapses, 4 deaths of athletes. And January 2022, 123 collapses, 86 deaths. Big difference, 11,000 times greater. There you go. Growing report. I'll do a little bit more of this, and then I'm going to take a break, and then I'll get into some we're almost done. So the growing report says this story will grow over time as new information is added. If you have proof of information that we don't already have, or if you have a correction, please send it through their contact form with as much information as possible. So there you go. Special thanks to the readers. You know, it says for the skeptics who believe this is normal, feel free to repeat the following 18 words after reading each record or name in this list. Repeat after reading this line. The COVID vaccine is a normal vaccine. The COVID vaccine is safe. These injuries and deaths are normal. And then this article has a huge amount of, it goes from March 2022. It's got this massive list of people who've died. And it goes back and back. It's got the whole list. It's got like all 500 people who've died by name. This is an incredible article. All right, this is what's going on here. So I love this. They even give you the line to repeat. You know, like I said, the vaccine is safe and effective. The vaccine is safe and effective. You will believe this. The vaccine is safe and effective. It's right here. Repeat after reading, you know, so each line. So the first line, Paul Michael Levesque, 52 years old, former professional wrestler under the stage name of Hunter Hearst Helmsley, or Triple H, died April 15th of 2021 in Massachusetts. Here's another one. Karnataka, India. Vinaya Vittal, 35 years old. Jim was working out in a health club in Bengaluru, India. Oh, it's a her, when she collapsed with suspected cardiac arrest. That was the 28th of March. Here's the 27th of March, England, dead, Thomas Rankin, 26, Redditch United midfield footballer, so he's a soccer player, had played there for 3 seasons and had previously played for the nearby Bromsgrove Sporting. He died suddenly, waiting for the details. Another one here, Romania, dead, Andrei Dragici, 23 years old, Dinamo Bucharest water polo player in Romania. England, March 25th. So this is like every day they're listening to this. Martin Dubravka, 33, Newcastle United football goalkeeper. Then go on from Australia, Hayden Crozier, 28. From Florida, Wayne Mackey, 62. From Greece, Christos Foufousekis, 29. Well, this goes on. They're all there. Dead. COVID shots. Okay, you tell me. You tell me what's going on. All right, take a break and come back with an article on the budget because we have a massive problem. We have a huge national debt of over $30 trillion. And the problem is that no one's doing anything about it. In fact, it's getting worse. And they're still trying to spend more money, print more money, borrow more money. Inflation's going up. They've starved us for energy, and we're in this horrible situation. So we looked at Action Radio to, you know, in the bill to find a bill that will fix the situation. And our 30-day public comment period, it won't stop them sending massive amounts of money, but it'll document it. Everybody gets to take a look. You'll have 30 days to react to all the stuff you'll see. That's a way to do it. All right, maybe I'll play you a classic interview. I haven't played this one for a while, but I love it. It's my Dr. Walter Williams interview. And it was one of the first interviews I did, certainly the first major person that I interviewed. And we talked about budgets, and we talked about Calvin Coolidge. I'm not going to give it all away. We talked about a bunch of incredible things. So this is WEBY. This would have been I started in March of 2017, so like May of 2017. I don't have the date posted on here. I can find it for you. But to consider it probably late spring, early summer of 2017, Dr. Walter Williams has now passed on. So this is an interview that is special to me because I got a chance to talk to someone I've wanted to talk to for years, and I got to do it obviously before they passed on because now that opportunity no longer exists. So this is Dr. Walter Williams talking about the economy, talking about Action Radio, talking about a bunch of different things. And so let me play this for you now. I'll be back after the presentation, and then we'll talk about our bill to mandate a 30-day comment period for anything that comes up in Congress over $100 million. Be back after the presentation. Yeah, baby. Time for the Action Radio Hour. It's 8:06 in the morning. I don't get the music down. I want to get to our guest right away, so let's introduce him now. Got my music? He doesn't have my music? Thank you very much. He received a PhD in economics from UCLA. He is an economics professor and former department head of George Mason University. He has authored over 150 publications, done tons of radio and television appearances, including mine, with more awards than I have time to mention. Let's have a round of applause for Dr. Walter Williams. Dr. Williams, thank you so much for coming on my show.
Good morning, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, believe me, it's my pleasure to have you on. I'm fairly new here, and I have questions I've wanted to ask you for years, so I want to get right to them. First of all, we're in a budget battle that's already started, and we have the national debt ceiling, national debt and the debt ceiling being raised as issues are coming up. But we've got this $20 trillion debt hanging over our heads. What does that mean for the economy, and how does that affect individual Americans?
Well, first, I think there's no hope of our ever paying off the national debt. That is, most countries that have a national debt, what they do is just simply repudiate it through inflation. That is, just destroy it through inflation. But what the national debt also means is that it's going to, when we see interest rates rise, it's going to be a huge part of the federal budget. And so, it's not good what we're doing as a nation. But, however, the national debt grows because the American people want Congress to do those kind of things that make it grow. That is, they want Congress to spend money.
Interesting. Has anybody done any forecast as to how much national debt our economy can actually support?
I don't know. Right now, the national debt is about 103% of the national debt is very, very large relative to GDP, but we're better off than many other countries, and there's no particular particular estimate that I know of where it rings the bells for disaster.
And here's the reason I'm asking that question is because I think the more important question is, if we don't know how much national debt our country can support, then how can Congress, in any good conscience at all, raise the debt ceiling?
Well, look, these people are politicians.
Yeah.
That is, look, you have to recognize that a congressman's, let's say a member of the House of Representatives, his time horizon is 2 years.
Okay.
A senator may be 4 or 6 years. Now, those people are not concerned about what happens to our country in 2030.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they might be dead by 2030. And if they do the kind of things now that protect our country in 2030, the American people will run them out of office.
Which brings up my next question, and that is, and I told you about this ahead of time, Calvin Coolidge being one of my favorite presidents, I looked up some numbers, and I got this from a Heritage Foundation article. Calvin Coolidge inherited in World War I and the Woodrow Wilson mess, just this horrible economy. But what he did was he cut spending 43% from 1921 to 1924. He dropped the highest tax bracket from 73% to 29%, and that went from 1921 to 1929, and reduced the national debt from $24 billion to $16.9 billion. So I translated...
And right after that, we had the Roaring Twenties.
Exactly, we had the Roaring Twenties. So what I'm getting to is, if that was repeated today, and I've run the numbers here, if Trump repeated that today, we'd have a current budget that would go from $4.3 trillion down to only $2.4 trillion. The top tax rate would go from 39.6 down to 15.7, and the national debt would be reduced from $20 trillion to about $14 trillion. What would that mean for our economy if we could repeat what Calvin Coolidge did to create the Roaring Twenties?
It would just be fantastic. It would be great for our economy. But President Trump just cannot do that. Look.
Yeah.
The major components of federal spending, of the federal budget, are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Now, touching those things is political suicide. And any president who's not going to do something about Social Security and Medicare is not really serious about reining in the federal spending.
Have you seen anything from the Trump administration that would lead you to think they're going to do something with these entitlements?
Well, I don't see any indications. That is, a person that gets into office and stays in office, he has to be a smart politician,
right?
And he can't listen to what Walter Williams will tell him, because that's political suicide.
I'm listening.
But you're not a politician.
Well, actually, what I'm trying to do, and I want to tell you about this speaker, I'm trying to take talk radio and make it action radio. And what that means is my audience becomes a citizen legislature. I'm going to be working with my local congressman. We're going to be writing bills on a website. We're going to be filing them. And so the whole idea is to change the relationship from the citizen to the government in a way that's never been done before, by using radio, by using the internet, by having a direct, you know, participation in writing legislation, because my guiding principle is that the people give their consent to be governed through writing the laws by which they are governed. And that's what I'm trying to bring in. So this is why I'm asking these questions, as what can we do as citizens? Is there any effect that an average person can have other than, you know, calling a politician to you know, affect economic policy?
Well, look. You live in the state of Florida.
Yes, sir.
And there are many retirees in the state of Florida.
Okay.
And you tell me what politician is going to say, is going to do anything about Social Security. He'll have the citizens, drawing and quartering him.
Hmm.
If you do anything to Social Security, and a lot of people, unfortunately, a lot of people believe that their Social Security check represents money that they put into it. That is not true. That is the only way a Social Security recipient can get one dime, is for the government to take money away from a worker who is a person who is already in the workforce.
Yeah.
There's no trust fund. It's a so-called pay-as-you-go system. And so, but I'm saying that any politician, and Social Security is going to go down the tubes. That is, by 2035 or 2040, it's just going to be unsustainable. But any politician doing anything that will cope with the problem of Social Security in 2030, 2040, it's political suicide.
Interesting. Have you seen...
One of the things we have to recognize, okay, I think, is that politicians are doing precisely what gets them elected office.
Yeah.
And upholding the United States Constitution, as our founders wrote it, is political suicide.
You know, it's funny you should mention that, because my next question is, has anybody done some work, and I'd love to work with someone in your department on this, in publishing what I call a constitutional budget? In other words, if we took just the items in Article 1, Section 8, things like maintaining the military, the interstate highway system, the various offices, the courts, and things like that, and we put specific budget amounts as if that were the budget, you know, how much would that actually cost? Has anyone?
It wouldn't come to $1 trillion.
Okay, so we're talking less than $1 trillion.
See, most of the federal spending can be characterized in the following way.
Okay.
That is, most federal spending is where Congress takes the property of one American and gives it to another American to whom it does not belong. I don't care whether you're talking about farm subsidies, business bailouts, food stamps, Medicare, Social Security, et cetera, et cetera. It represents, you know, another way of doing it, another way of expressing it, it's legalized theft.
Right.
That is Congress taking from one American, giving it to another, and that's not in the Constitution.
Yeah. I still would like to do that, and so I'm hoping I can write you off the air and see if I can get someone to actually put dollar amounts to each of the items in Article 1, Section 8, because I want to write an article on this. I want to publish it, and I think if I can present that to my congressman and say, look, this is what a constitutional budget looks like. This is what you guys are doing, and I think if people are aware of that and how far we've gone from the Constitution, it you know, at least it's an educational thing, it might make a bit of a difference.
Well, I would hope so. I mean, and I would hope so because the future of our country depends on it, and the future of liberty depends on it. And we Americans have an awesome responsibility. That is, if liberty dies in the United States, it's dead for all times, for all people, for all over the world. And so we Americans have an awesome responsibility to make sure that liberty persists in the United States. And what we're doing now is the exact opposite of that.
Yeah, and that's why I'm trying my bit. I mean, I've got a vision for Action Radio, and I'm getting a lot of help here and a lot of support, and I have this job to be able to do it. But that's part of it, is to have much more of a direct representation.
But here's a question for you to ponder. That is, we have to ask the question, are the American people, as human beings, are we any different from the Romans, from the Portuguese, the French, the British? These are great empires of the past.
Right.
They went down the tubes for precisely what we're doing, bread and circuses. Now, what is it about American people as human beings that make us any different from them?
That's a great question. All I can think of is we have more history, we have the internet, we have more information at our disposal, we have more instant communication. A regular person like me that was a tour guide in San Francisco 3 months ago is now on radio. I can talk to you directly, whereas people in like Roman times, I don't think they could talk directly to their senators, you know, and the government officials. They were, and for most people, you know, people in power are way beyond us regular folks out here. So, but I think with education, with the instant communication we have, and with considering things that have never been considered before, like regular people writing legislation, maybe that'll make a difference.
Well, I hope you're right.
I'm going to try.
Indeed, I hope you're right, because the future of America depends on our doing something different from what we're doing.
Can I ask you a couple more questions?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. One thing I was wondering is the unemployment figures. Whenever they're given, we get the U3 rate, which is like 4.9%. We get U6, which is a little bit higher. But I found a website called Shadow Stats by John Miller, I think. And what he's reporting is that the actual unemployment rate is 22.7% because they include long-term discouraged workers who aren't counted in the U3 and U6 rates. Is that accurate, and would that better describe why our economy is so sluggish if actually 22% of people are unemployed?
That sounds a bit high, but not. I would put it somewhere around 15%. That's the number I'm hearing.
Okay.
If you include the so-called discouraged worker,
right.
And one of the reasons why we have these, I think it's about 92 million people who are capable of working, not working. The reason why we have such a number is because of the welfare state.
Okay.
That is, these people can afford to say, well, I'm not going to take that job at McDonald's for $7.25 an hour and $8 an hour because I can get unemployment compensation. I can get food stamps. I can get many other things.
Hmm.
And if you look at historically, the duration of unemployment since 1948, I believe, has tripled.
Okay.
Now, if not taking a job at $8 or $9 an hour, if that meant starvation, people would not do it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean starvation.
Well, we used to have a workfare program where you had to work something. You know, if you were an able-bodied person, you couldn't just stay on welfare.
Now, that's right. And then there's another question that one might ask, that we've been a nation since 1792 or 1787, whatever number whatever year you want to put it.
Okay.
But we became the greatest nation on the face of earth without all these programs that people today say are absolutely necessary.
So they're
that
not.
Is, we didn't have any welfare until the Roosevelt administration.
Right.
We did not have an unemployment compensation, I believe, not until the 1940s.
Yeah.
And we didn't have all these programs that people say is absolutely necessary, before. In the 1950s, 60s, and 70s.
Yeah. Another thing we didn't have that I reported on in the previous hour was the withholding tax that came in 1943, right in the middle of World War II.
Yeah,
and
right.
It's what, 62 years later or something? The article.
And you know what?
Yeah, go ahead.
And very interestingly, it was called a victory tax.
Oh, interesting.
It was called the victory tax because the government was saying, if we can get money to the government more quickly, that will help us win the war.
Yeah. Well,
so as Milton, as my colleague and mentor, Milton Friedman, used
right.
to say, there's nothing more permanent than a temporary federal program.
Or a tax, temporary tax. We have an issue here. We're voting on another temporary tax for 10 years.
Right. Matter of fact, they just repealed, I think 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
the tax on telephones that was supposed to finance the Spanish-American War.
Wow. What would happen if we actually could get rid of it? This is one of my legislative agenda items. If we didn't have a withholding tax and Americans had to physically, I mean, they couldn't just have an automatic deduction, but if they had to physically, every time tax was due, whether it was weekly, monthly, quarterly, or by the year, what do you think that would have an effect on the economy and the rate of taxation?
I think it would have a very important effect because the average American has no idea how much taxes he's paying.
Right.
The withholding tax makes paying taxes to the federal government and the state government, it makes it less painful than it otherwise would be. Now, if I had it my way, I would require, before changing anything about taxes, that people pay their taxes, go to the post office, pay their taxes, and count it out in $5 bills and have the whole family present with them.
Oh, wow. Well, tax collectors in the old days, when we're talking about older civilizations, they would come to your house. They would take things. They would take your livestock. They would take your money. They would take whatever. And people knew exactly what they were paying because it was going right out the door.
Yeah. And keep in mind, since between 1787
mm-hmm.
and 1913, we did not have an income tax except for a short period during the Civil War.
Yeah.
That was ruled unconstitutional. And we were able to run our government on sales tax tariffs and excise taxes. Now, but however, government was very small. That is, between 1787 and 1920, except during war,
mm-hmm.
the federal government was only 3% of the GDP.
And what's it now?
Today, the federal government is around 25 and 30% of the GDP.
Wow.
And so you need an oppressive system like the Internal Revenue Code to get that amount of money from the American people.
Hmm. You mentioned Social Security is one of the big exploding time bombs coming up. Have you studied the Chilean retirement system, and would a privatized system like that work here?
Would you repeat the question?
The Chilean system where I think they have a mandatory
10%
withholding, but it's a private account. It goes to you. It doesn't go to the government to pay other people. Could that work here? How could that work here? And would that solve our Social Security
problem? I think that would be an improvement over the status quo.
Okay.
If I had it my way, what I would do is that I would tell every American who is over age 45,
mm-hmm.
look, we will live up to our commitments and pay you your Social Security benefits out of general revenues.
Okay.
For all people under 25, I would tell them, forget whatever money you put in, under 45,
okay.
Forget whatever money you put into Social Security, go out and get your own retirement system.
Interesting.
And so, and the reason why 45, I choose 45, is that between 45 and 65,
mm-hmm.
and if you put your money in a private retirement system, you would break even with what you would get in Social Security.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Thing we can't abandon people
right.
who have made their plans based on what the government told them, the big lie about Social Security. So we have to find some way to take care of those people. But let's say we can just prevent the system from getting worse.
Interesting. I want to throw something open to you now because I've been asking a lot of questions, but what is going on in economic theory now? What new developments do you have? You know, are the models working? Is there something new to take a look at the economy to explain it better? What do you guys do at George Mason?
Well, we teach real economics.
Okay.
I think that one of the things that's happening to our profession, which I think is disastrous, is that it's becoming too mathematical. And now, as I tell, I teach my PhD. In fall, I teach the first year PhD students their economic theory,
mm-hmm.
and I tell them that economics is not math, and math is not economics, but math is a very, very valuable tool in economics.
Okay.
But too many people, distinguished places like University of Penn, MIT, they teach math instead of really economics. And here we teach economics. Some of my colleagues are top people in public choice analysis or the Austrian theories of economics.
Can you explain that Austrian theory real quickly? Because I want to get one of those folks on with me too.
Well, yeah. Well, the Austrian. It has to do with the economics of Friedrich Hayek,
okay.
and many others who are from the Austrian school of economics. But, however, as Milton Friedman used to say, he used to say there's only two kinds of economists: good economists and bad economists.
And if you make the wrong forecast, yeah.
As opposed to people saying Keynesian economists, Austrian
right.
economists, free market economists, he just says it's good economists and bad economists.
Okay. I've got one of my wilder ideas is to have what I call brainstorm day, where I get maybe you and Newt Gingrich and maybe Herman Cain and maybe Mike Huckabee and a few other folks, Ann Coulter, together, and we brainstorm questions that no one else is asking. And one of the questions I've been trying to wrestle with is regulatory agencies as a model, I think, is a terrible way to govern. I think there has to be a new way to enforce the laws that the legislature passes and the executive signs, but regulatory agencies become these little kingdoms. They grow, they take on more responsibility, they think their regulations are law, and there's like bypassing the legislative process. Is there another way to get our laws enforced that is not a regulatory agency? Is there a new model that we could come up with to handle that responsibility? Has anybody?
Well, I think we just have to go back and look at our history.
Okay.
That is, we say, well, what in the world did we do before we had all these regulatory agencies?
Okay.
And then another big problem is that Congress has become derelict in its responsibilities. That is, it's given much of their responsibilities to regulatory agencies.
Interesting.
And the regulatory agencies, as you said, they become little fiefdoms, and where people have all kinds of legislative power that's not that they're not supposed to have. That is, Congress has delegated much of its responsibilities to these regulatory agencies. And matter of fact, congressmen, they don't understand much of what they pass.
Yeah, because they pass it and then they read it.
Yeah, right.
So you'd probably be in favor then of a bill to have bills be one subject. And I think Thomas Jefferson wanted, you know, bills to stay on the table for a year before they were voted on to give everybody input on them.
And Trump has an interesting idea. For each
that?
New regulation, they have to get rid of three or two, whatever he said.
Yeah, I'm not a great fan of formulas. The same way I'm not a big fan of term limits because, you know, you might get three corrupt people in the space of one corrupt person. And I would like to see entire, you know, areas of regulation be done away with, you know, especially when they talk about the whole global warming hoax and you know, carbon dioxide being a pollutant when it's really a plant fertilizer. So there's a question. Has anybody accounted for the cost of this whole global warming thing? How much is that taken out of our, of
right.
our productivity?
Well, there are people that have the Heartland Institute. They've done it. And then actually for you and many of the listeners, you can go to my website. It's WalterEWilliams.com, and I give their book recommendations and their recommended websites and their my publications and my videos and other things that are available on their website.
I have more questions for you, but I know you wanted to go at some point.
Yes, we have to.
But I got you now, so I'm having so much fun. But I hope I can get you back sometime soon.
That'd be nice, yeah.
Do you have any closing comments or advice for me for Action Radio?
No. One of the topics of my last column, I pointed out that true liberty is not for wimps. You have to be a brave person to be for liberty.
Liberty not for wimps. I'm going to read that column. I'm going to present it to my audience here. And I want to thank you, Dr. Williams, so much for coming on my show. And the extra time that you gave, I really appreciate that.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, you have a wonderful day, sir. All right, and that was Dr. Walter Williams of George Mason University. And that is, I think, the most incredible conversation I've ever had with anybody, certainly in my short 3 weeks here. If this is the kind of guest you want, if you want this kind of information, if this is something that is appealing to you, let me know, please, because I'm going to try and get the very best that I can for you. We're going to take a break now. The phone number is 623-1330, 623-1330. I spent so much time, you know, preparing my questions for Dr. Williams. I still didn't get to them all, but I have more things. If you want to talk, now's your chance, because I really don't have a whole lot else to do, because I really want to make sure that I maximized my time with Dr. Williams. He was just fabulous. So let's take a break. It's 1330 WEBY, 8:30 in the morning, and I'll be back. And that's the way it was, you know, back at WEBY. That was about, 4 years ago now. And so it was actually about 4 years ago. It would have been the spring of 2017 when I did that. Chappie's on the line, so let's get to him in just a second here.
Action Radio. Dangerously cool.
Oh, we have so much fun here. So Donnie Chapman, otherwise known as Chappie, if you get a chance, you want to listen to just one of the my favorite interviews of all time. It was that one I just played with Dr. Walter Williams because Derek Park wasn't here. And I thought, well, we're going to play this economic. And I'm looking through my audio clips and I go, oh, yeah, Dr. Williams. You know, brilliant, absolutely brilliant man. And it was just fabulous to talk to him. This is my first big interview. And so I'd overprepared. I had about, 6 hours worth of questions just in case because I didn't know what was going to happen. But that's back in my early days of radio back in 2017. Good morning, sir. How you doing? What's happening in gun world?
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm having a great time. Everybody's missing, though. Yep. Jim is off today. Derek's off today. Shirley only had half an hour. Alan in Belize, it's 2 hours earlier now because our daylight saving time change. So it's basically, Shirley was on for a bit, and now you. I've been sort of vamping the rest of the time.
Oh, yeah. There's not much going on in shooting world going on other than there's a big match the USPSA Area 6 that's going on right now in North Carolina that's starting to take place. Mm-hmm. It usually takes place in Frostproof, Florida, but they moved its location this year.
Oh, no.
Other than that, our match went really well last Saturday, our second USPSA match at Escambia River Gun Club. So we're already starting to prep for our next one in May, which we're going to kind of have a May the Force be with you kind of theme. So each month we're kind of doing a theme.
If you want someone to do the advertisement for that, I can bring in Yoda. The Force is strong with you today. Going to be good.
We'd still love to have you come out and check it out. So
yes, I will.
Or tomorrow we're having a field challenge match at Escambia River Gun Club too. So I think this match is going to be kind of the build up. Everybody's going to start using this to get ready for the big world shoot that Gatlin's going to shoot at in Terrence. So,
oh yeah, I'm getting there.
For 24th.
Yeah, I'm getting closer to a place where I can do that. Actually, it's funny. I just jammed with a guitar player trying to start another rock band, which is a perpetual activity of mine as well. So it's guns, guitars, and airplanes are my big three. And I want to get flying again as well. So there's a lot of things to do, but definitely we're getting pretty close. I'm looking at the guns, getting them sort of, checked out, cleaned out, you know, lubricated properly, but not too much, you know, all that kind of good stuff. So we're getting very close to when I will take you up on your offer to get it and do so. So this is going to be fascinating. This is going to be so much fun to get back into it. And I'm curious. I mean, I still know how to do it, but I haven't done it for a while. And so I'm curious to see what I might have lost over that amount of time and how quickly it takes me to get back into it. So that's a good thing, too. So actually, let's talk about that. For people that haven't shot for a while, recommendations for how to get back. What do you think the best way to get folks back in shape?
Honestly, the best way is just go out and do it or take a class,
mm-hmm.
find a one-on-one instructor to just kind of go over everything else. The first thing first, though, is kind of go over all the safety procedures with yourself because, you know, there's something you might forget and all that stuff. But you also brought a good thing, too. Break out your firearms, safety check them, lubricate them, make sure they're in operating order. And probably, you know, like I said, go find an instructor to kind of get you back into it. Sometimes it's just like riding a bike, though. Once you get out there, you realize you haven't lost anything. So that would be the best thing. And join a range. That would be another thing to kind of get you back into it. So, but the main important thing, of course, there is safety. You definitely want to make sure your firearms are operating safely and that you're being safe. So there's, you know, other websites you can look at too. I would probably get on NRA's website, kind of go over the safety aspects of it, where to shoot, where to find an instructor too.
So it raises another question. You know, again, half of my questions come from things that I think of as I'm talking to people. If someone knows they're not going to shoot for a while, I mean, they take care of their guns. So like long-term preservation, how would one do that?
Definitely do a complete tear down, another inspection. And I would just, you're not going to use it for quite a while. Definitely oil them really well. Like use more than what you normally would use because it's going to be in storage. And
right.
then I would definitely put it in the gun safe.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you're in an area like here in Florida that has a lot of humidity, there's these little things you can put in there that kind of draw out the humidity or even desiccant mm-hmm. packs, you know, like when you buy a pair of shoes, I would put those in there. You're going to want something that's going to absorb the moisture instead of letting all that moisture sit there on your firearm. But that's what I'd recommend. Just over oil it where it has that wet appearance on the firearm itself.
Okay.
So that oil is going to just really soak up. And there's other things too. Even if you have an AR-15, a lot of people use, I wouldn't go overboard with it because it'd be a pain in the butt to clean off, but even putting some type of light grease or lithium grease on your bolt and even other areas that you are prone to rusting, I would probably put that on there as well too. Because like that, especially here, the humidity is what's going to damage firearms here with all that. Rust prevention is easier than taking off rust, so.
Yeah, that's for sure. How about the wood itself? How does one preserve if you have a wooden stock or wooden attachments on a gun?
You know, honestly, some of the best stuff for the wood is like using pledge, some type of wood polish. There's like Casey Birchwood makes a type of like a wood polish and stuff like that. But even if you don't have anything that fancy, just putting pledge on there helps too because it'll help it from drying out. So,
interesting.
And they all smell fresh like lemon. So,
yeah. Hey, here's my new AK-47. It smells fresh too. We can make a commercial on that. Has some nice like springtime music in the background. And here we are at the range with my new AK-47. It's got a beautiful lemon smell, and it looks fresh too. The metal is gleaming. fun with it. There's not enough humor in gun stuff. We gotta, you know. So, did you like my Yoda impression, or you don't want that for your commercial?
I did.
Okay. I'm willing to, you know, voiceover for a commercial for your May 4th event. I'm available.
Oh yeah. Come on out. I mentioned too about oil. There's also it's called Ballistol. It's kind of one all be all. You can use it on. Of course, the firearm, the metal of the firearm, it's okay to get it on the wood, and it's okay for those shooting plastic firearms too. So it's not gonna hurt anything. So if you want a one all be all Ballistol, it doesn't smell too bad. Like I said, it's I wouldn't say it's really oily, but it's not one of those ones that's gonna quickly soak into the metal. It works really well. I use it a lot of my pistol barrels on the outside because it's going to stay there. It's not going to have a quick burn-off rate.
Interesting. Yeah, it's funny. I get kind of crazy when it comes to, you know, protecting the gun. So I'll have the gun safe open. If it's a humid day, I have a little fan, you know, blowing air, circulating air through it. I have one of these humidifying, you know, water absorbing. In fact, it's full. I have to get a new one. There's moisture eliminator things. Yeah, because, you know, when, you don't want to, you know, they're too valuable. You know, same thing. I mean, you know, fortunately, my guitars all have some kind of a finish, a polyurethane coating. So they're not really affected as much by the humidity. But they're not in a case either. They're outside, and so I tend to leave things, you know, out in the fresh air, and, you know, work the actions of guns, you know, if I, especially again, if I haven't used them for a while, you know, they're lubricated. I just, you know, periodically go through, work all the actions, and just, you know, make sure that the parts are, you know, trying to do my good stuff, so that when I do get to this, I'll be able to just get the range and get out there. And, you know, I got a couple of revolvers. I want to learn how to use my revolvers better. So that's some kind of fun too. Yeah. So, oh yeah, listen, I'm gonna believe me. We're gonna do some shooting. It's just a question of when. And I think we're, you know, I keep saying that, but I think we're getting fairly close. There's so much going on in Action Radio. We've got an Australian Bill of Individual Rights that's going to be released fairly soon, and then we've got a whole bunch of legislation. I'll be meeting with. You're close enough. I don't know if you're available. Oh, you're shooting tomorrow, right? You got a match tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, we're shooting at Bill's house tomorrow.
Oh, that's right, yeah, because we've got the Saturday, I think, Greg. We've got the Matt Gaetz, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene event. So it was at their campaign headquarters in Fort Walton Beach, and now they're going to be meeting in a couple of places, Crestview, I think up in Jay, which is the northern part of our little county here, and over in McAdams, which I don't even know where that is. But the point is there was some incredible legislation. One of those things, and this is if we can coordinate this better maybe next time, because, you know, or through the campaign, we have our Second Amendment bill, which has things like, you know, tax credits and tax deductions, you know, so that folks of low income will have, as the liberals would say, access to quality firearms and ammunition. So that'd be a great bill for you to present to them and say, here, you know, here's a bill that has Second Amendment tax credits, you know, as a way to, you know, the best off, you know, the best defense is a good offense. So let's get proactive. And these are two folks that might actually get it into Congress and say, well, that's a good idea. Let's see what happens. You know, so we could put together something like that. So with some of the gun clubs, gun, you know, companies around here, your fellow salespeople, I think that would be this is the time to do it, you know, before the 2024 election in November, that we could probably, you know, get some gun legislation to some people who probably, you know, at least have the best chance of supporting it. So there's a thought for you too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I saw Matt Gaetz was kind of doing like a little local tour, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, that's tomorrow.
Getting
out with the people. So I'll be at Crestview, the first one, and see if I can talk to him. And well, I talked to him in the last one, but I haven't met Marjorie Taylor Greene yet. And I actually have contact with a couple of folks in her office, so I want to tell her the fact that we do exist, that we have citizen legislation. We have a bunch of things. In fact, I'll be going over one of the bills. The two big ones are the vaccine product liability and the ending of big tech censorship. But there's a bill that I'll be talking about after we chat that has the financial – the Financial Accountability Public Disclosure Act of 2019. And what this was a bill I wrote for a previous massive budget battle national debt increase. You know, it says it requires a 30-day comment period. So they can't have final passage on a budget bill until everybody's had a chance to look at it for 30 days. And that would include the members of Congress. And so I'll be going over that too. So there's a lot of stuff we cover here that I think is quite fascinating. Yeah. Anyway, I know you're busy. You got stuff to do for the match, but anything else you need to? Anything else you wanted to cover, or and of course, give you your requisite plugs.
No, that's it. Just the requisite clubs. If anybody needs to find me, they can find me on Facebook.com/ChappieTactical or Instagram at ChappieTactical. For anybody who's interested in shooting USPSA in the local area, we're the Escambia River Practical Shooters, and our home range is at Escambia River Gun Club in Cantonment, Florida, so it's not too far in the area. And I'm doing a membership drive right now, so come out and join the range. And we can't
tell me about that,
Greg. So.
Got a deal?
Yeah. So
what's the deal?
So right now it's $140 for a year, but that includes you and your spouse and any of your children under the age of 18. And unlike some other ranges where, even though you're a member, you still have to pay an additional fee. Not at Escambia River. We have, of course. We have four ranges, or actually five ranges, so that you always have plenty of spaces outdoors. We have three ranges that are out to 150 yards right now. We're pushing, getting ready to start breaking ground, push one to 600 yards. We do have five competition bays are in the back of the range, and right now we also started digging on an additional 40 acres that we acquired to build six huge competition bays. It's almost going to be another range. So, it's a great place to go. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you basically almost most of the time it's never because of the way it's spread out and there's so many ranges there, you're never right on top of another person shooting. So, it's a great time. Like I said, we do many competitions out there. It's family friendly. So, come out and join Escambia River Gun Club and, that's it. I can't wait to get you out there, Greg, and we'll definitely get field challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely want to do it. Yeah. It's just, like I say, the because you're running your own company, that when you do your own company, you have to answer for everything. It just keeps you busy. And I just got one last question. So I don't have to walk 600 yards to check my target. what device do you have? Do you have a gong? Do you have a bell? Do you have a trash can lid?
There's large gongs out there. I know the range master is also looking into getting type of computer system and camera system that they use at the civilian marksmanship program up in Talladega. Because I was helping them look for that piece of equipment. So there's going to have some things out there so you can kind of have a true to life. See what your target.
And you actually have a camera on the target. See, that'd be fascinating. See, that's the biggest problem. When I used to do the 1,000-yard matches, it's a lot of walking. But that's where you separate them in.
A lot of driving a golf cart.
Yeah. Oh, a golf cart would be nice.
That's an option we brought up. So I think they're looking at purchasing like another Gator or 4x-wheel drive little mechanism. So, but yeah, come on out. Like I said, it's a lot of changes going on out there for the better. And because it is a club, you don't have just any Joe Schmo walking up the street with a hand cannon shooting next to you like at some indoor ranges. So it's
you're not training gangbangers to shoot.
giving
gangbangers a chance to practice. Yeah, okay, that's a good thing. Okay, all right. Well, that sounds good. Well, I like the idea of a gong, and I love this idea of a camera because again, when I was doing 1,000-yard competitions, we had a military style pit. And so the bullets, if you hit the crack over your head, which is really kind of fascinating, if no one's ever heard that, combat veterans know it, people that, and competition shooters, if you have this kind of thing. But when you get 1,000 yards back, that I still say that separates the men from the boys, or the women from the girls. That if you can shoot 1,000 yards, there's something that happens between, even that 200 yards, between 800 and 1,000. 600 is actually not too bad, especially if you have a range finding scope. 800, it's kind of challenging too, but 1,000, I don't know what happens between that last 200 yards. But 1,000 yards, it just the wind, the gravity, the 308 bullets, that's where they go subsonic. Something really horrible happens that last 200 yards, and it just makes it 10 times tougher for some reason. But I find it fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Shift of the wind, everything. So, have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jeppy. And I'll start marking my calendar saying, Greg, it's time to go out the shooting range. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely. We'll get you out there. All right.
Oh, I know. All right. Take care. Donnie Chappie Chapman. And so we have two of our regular reports today, which is not bad considering, we had, I'm always going to happen one day when I like the whole Friday and I have nobody call. Anyway, lines are open, 215-383-3832. Feel free to give us a call. Any issue anything we've talked about, I'm going to go over a bill. I've got maybe another article on reasons that you want to drop your party membership in Republicans and Democrats. And anything else you want to talk about is going to be pretty fair game. We can kind of tie up the week. We started off, we've changed transgender, through gender dysphoria to what I call gender conflicted. That's a topic, too. That's going to be around with us for a while. And the fact that we have a Marxist racist on the Supreme Court now, replacing an arch liberal. So it's not as bad as it could have been, if Clarence Thomas was replaced by, I've forgotten her first name, Letitia Brown Jackson. Is it Letitia? Anyway, I'll take a look. I can't pronounce her first name. I haven't looked it up. Anyway, but the thing is, at least we're having a Marxist replacing a liberal, which is not as bad as it could be, but I think she will go down in history as one of the worst choices for Supreme Court of all time. And not because she's a black woman, but because she's a Marxist and she likes, critical race theory and all those things too. I was surprised that nobody asked her. I said, considering your critical race thing, what's your opinion of white people? I mean, let's just be bold about it. Let's just see that would have been a great question to ask her. You're being appointed as a black woman. Do black women see the Constitution different than white men? And if so, how? Because the words are the same, unless you're reading them differently. You know, and there's so many things that they could have gotten into, but they don't, because, you know, they're geldings. All right, back in a little bit. Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Penglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com.
Joe Biden's dark winter. No freedom, no liberty, no guns, no representation, no oil, no coal, no nuclear power, no space force, no constitution, no family gatherings, no vacations, just taxes, work, misery, masks, lockdowns, and ever more government. This is what will happen if you let Marxists steal the election. This has been a public service announcement of Action Radio, reminding you it's time to get off your butt and save your country. This is Greg Penglis for Strike Force, your source for pure energy. Strike Force is a concentrated energy drink that turns a half liter of your favorite beverage into an energy drink. It contains caffeine, taurine, B vitamins, and potassium. You make your energy drink yourself. Here's how. Add one pack to a standard half liter water bottle or 16 ounce glass to create a full power energy drink. No sugar, no calories, no stirring, no shaking. Strike Force energy drinks come in original, grape, lemon, and orange. Each flavor pack is a liquid that adds an explosion of flavor to any beverage. Here's the best part. Action Radio is an affiliate of Strike Force, so our listeners get a 20% discount. All you do is add our code, WYL, to the discount code window at checkout. That's WYL. WYL comes from our website, Write Your Laws. So, you can get your energy drink, get a 20% discount, and help Action Radio change the relationship of we the people to our government. Not bad. Strike Force is at StrikeForceEnergy.com. That's StrikeForceEnergy.com. Start your engines.
This is Greg Penglis. So what is Action Radio? It is a radio show with its own citizen legislature. That's you, the listener. It is a fully interactive system of listeners, expert guests, social media, writing bills, legislator input, bill submission, lobbying, and citizen action. Action Radio is the future of talk radio using all the available technology in one completely integrated new system. You are listening to Action Radio Online with Greg Penglis. The webpage for all Action Radio shows and podcasts is blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Please share our show with all your friends and family, both nationally and internationally. The guiding principle of Action Radio is this: we the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed.
There we go. Sounds better when I turn the mic on. Okay, we're back. Let me bring up a bill here and get you all. Oh, that's not the one I want. That's the other. Where am I go? Ah, here we go. Nope, that's not it either. This is confusing. I know I put it somewhere here. That's not it. Here we go. Excuse me. I need someone to organize me for my show, as you can tell. All right. So again, anybody wants to call in, 215-383-8832. Let me just check. My mic is live. Yep. Did it right this time. So that's a good thing. Let's move this over here, this over here, this over here, and there we can go. So the problem that keeps coming up, if you notice the budget battle, it's the same budget battle every time. The Congress appropriates a whole bunch of money. They vote themselves just a ton of spending, and then they say, well, we have to raise the debt ceiling to meet our obligations. Well, they're doing it backwards. They're actually making their obligations before they have the money to meet them. That'd be like if you have a $1,000 limit on your credit card, charging $1,500 worth of stuff, and then saying, "Well, the credit card company has to raise the credit limit to meet my obligations." That's what they're saying. All right? That's what the Congress says. You know, and it's a big lie. It happens all the time. It's going to happen in September too. And, you can predict it as much as the rainy season in the springtime. That there is going to be members of Congress are going to say, "Well, we can't default. We have to meet our obligations. We have to be able to pay our bills. We can't default on our bills." Well, the problem is that they made the bills in the first place. I mean, that was a voluntary action to vote for things, to vote for spending when they didn't have the money to pay for the spending. I mean, they get $4.5 trillion every year in revenue. You would think that would be enough to run the government, and it is actually probably, as we talked about with Dr. Walter Williams, the constitutional budget is, he said, less than $1 trillion. So let's just say $1 trillion for the sake of argument. So if you take in $4.5 trillion in revenue and you only need $1 trillion to run the government, you've got $3.5 trillion of surplus. Well, ordinarily that should have been given back in a tax cut, right? You would think, okay, to the people that are paying most of the taxes, which are the rich. So there'll be a huge tax cut, a huge wealth increase, and a huge amount of spending increase, and more jobs, more companies, more kinds of more wealth for the nation. But they don't do that. They'd rather spend the money themselves, waste it, create more inflation, ruin the economy, and do whatever that the Marxists and the things do. And so to try and break that cycle, I came up with a bill called the Financial Accountability and Public Disclosure Act of 2019. And this was written December 30th, almost the last day of 2019. This is really a 2020 bill. So in fact, this was written, right before COVID hit. It's kind of funny. I mean, right before COVID hit, so there was initial reports of it out there, but the next month we had the China travel ban from Donald Trump. And this was written in December. Travel ban was in, was this about the time? This is about the time I think I had COVID. It was kind of funny. So I must've been mad. When I get mad, I get creative. So the point is, let me just read the introduction and you get an idea what this bill does. And if you want to support this bill, this is one that you can go to writeyourlaws.com. Okay. Scroll down to all proposed. Well, you get to, excuse me. Go to writeyourlaws.com. WriteYourLaws, writeyourlaws.com. And you look at the menu bar, you'll see legislation. And then just follow it down. You can just look, you should look at them all individually because the first one tells you how to write and submit a bill to us. But if you get down to all proposed laws, these are the ones that are in Congress. These are the ones that should be in the media, and people should be sharing to Congress and to talk shows and media outlets and things like that. So that's where you find it. WriteYourLaws.com, click on legislation, click on all proposed laws, and you'll get to the Financial Accountability and Public Disclosure Act, which says in the introduction, little noticed during the final agonizing throes of the House Democrat impeachment hearings was a budget bill. Snuck through a vote dead of the night. Like so many before it, this bill spends billions of dollars. That's with a B. B as in Bob. B as in Bravo. B as in billions of dollars. There were no hearings I know of on it, and it was put together by lobbyists and leadership members who, in effect, did all the legislating. The Senate and House regular members, facing an imminent government shutdown by design, were forced into a horrible choice. Approve the spending or shut down the government. And the biggest problem of all was that the members had no idea what was in the bill or the previous budget bill or the other bills like it or any of the continuing resolutions or any spending bill where all the provisions of the bill only appear in the bill after the bill is passed. Okay. The members had no time to read the bill, to ask questions, to think of other options, to make amendments, to consult with their constituents, to talk about it on the media so the public would be informed. In fact, no legislative function was allowed at all because of the incredible time constraints and the pressure to just do it now. That is completely unacceptable. Next paragraph says, this new standard of budgets and appropriations so eloquently articulated by Speaker Nancy Pelosi in the Obamacare debate that you have to, quote, pass the bill to see what's in it, unquote, is in fact legislation in reverse, and it is the current standard of the congressional budgeting. That is unconstitutional. It is not in a Republican form of government to have leadership and lobbyists budget by secret deal in return for campaign and other contributions from their favorite lobbyists. That's bribery, or in the current trendy language, a quid pro quo. Lobbyists cannot replace legislators in a republic, and leadership cannot replace membership in the House and Senate. Fortunately, there is a rather simple solution. That's the thing I'm finding with legislation. Most of the solutions are very simple. It does not take a lot of work. Well, it takes work, but it doesn't take a huge amount of time to find the problems. And when you write the problems, you know, a lot of our bills only have three or four lines that actually change law. You know, it takes three or four lines to put full product liability back on vaccine makers. It takes three or four lines to fix all the problems in big tech censorship. This one doesn't take a whole lot either, but I've got some. This one actually is a little longer. So the solution. Now, I don't have a place in the budget where this would go. This is more of a and this is what we need kind of thing. It has some pretty strong provisions. First provision: no bill which includes a budget, a continuing resolution, a reset of the debt ceiling, an appropriation, or any bill with an expenditure beyond $100 million shall be put up for a final vote of the House and Senate until there has been a separate for each bill public disclosure and comment time period of 30 days on a public internet site from the date any such bills are placed in their final form. Publication of any such bill shall take place after all individual votes and any conference votes for both House and Senate. This bill is intended for public disclosure and comment of the final form of the bill, not bills that are still in process. So in other words, when the House is taking a look at a bill, because revenue bills have to originate in the House. So the House is taking a look at it. They send it to the Senate. Senate changes it, sends it back to the House. House changes it back again, you know, and then the Senate says, okay, we need a conference. And they get together and they hammer out a bill. Once that's done, once the bill is final form, all the amendments are there, all the things they're going to do to it are there, it's ready to be voted on. That's when it goes to the 30-day comment period. That's what I said in that initial part. Okay, that's how it works. So not only would the media get a chance to look at it, you would get a chance to look at it, and most importantly, the members of Congress would get a chance to take a look at it. That might be their first look at the bill. You know, they might have done this entire legislative process not knowing what was in the bill until it was finally disclosed in the public. That I find fascinating. Second provision, any amendments to any of the bills that fall under the criteria for a 30-day public disclosure and comment period after that period has ended shall result in 7 additional days of public disclosure and comment for the amendments such that no provision of any bill covered by this act makes it into law without some period of disclosure and comment. So they got the 30 days and they're like, oh, we're going to make a change. Okay. See, this is what Congress would do, right? They'd give you your 30-day comment period, then they change the whole bill and vote on it. Well, you can't do that because you get 7 more days of disclosure for any change. You know, so hopefully, I don't know if I can write that for every change, you get 7 more days. So they make 5 changes, you get, you know, 5 times 7 is 35. That might be a bit much. But yeah, we'll see. But anyway, so they can't just, you know, sneak through changes and say, okay, no problem. We just made a couple of amendments. Now we'll vote on it. No. Whatever gets voted on has to have the 30-day and then the 7-day for amendments afterwards. All right. 3, there shall be no exceptions to this law except for a declared war by an act of Congress and signed by the president. So this is why it's so important to always have laws that have a provision that says in an emergency, this law still has effect, which it does. You know, the Constitution doesn't have to say that because it doesn't have an on or an off switch. Constitution's already enforced by virtue of it being ordained and established. So those are the keywords. So this says, unless there's a declared war, yeah, you got to have a 30-day comment period for a budget because you might not have time to war. In a declared war, not a fake war, not a war that, you know, the president sends a bunch of troops or Brandon sends a bunch of troops in. And then after, you know, 60 days, they say, well, what do you think? Was that legal? Congress says, oh, yes, let me send you more troops. You know, we know how that works, right? So that's the point of that one. Number 4, there shall be no exception because of recess, holiday, the end of the current session, or any other calendar reason. Plan for all these ahead of time. Yeah, so they can't just, you know, put it at the end of the legislative calendar. Oh, we've only got 5 days left in the, you know, in this year's legislative session. Nah, you still have to have your 30-day period, so tie it over to the next one. There shall especially be no exceptions for imminent government shutdowns. If the government shuts down during the 30-day public disclosure and comment period, then it stays shut down until the 30 days are finished. So there you go. So interrupt the comment period. You know, you got to spend much more time in the comment period. You know, the comment period gets extended. Anyway, that's how that works. That's interesting. But I've got more provisions. I just don't want to read them all. I'm getting bored. You're probably getting bored too. I'd rather talk to somebody. If nobody calls in, I'll just, you know, shut the show down. I mean, I imagine people are doing things. The weather's nice. They're out of here. So I've had enough reading bills, had enough reading articles. I'd much rather talk to somebody that's interested in discussing, you know, like why I should remain a Republican, you know, rather than having left like I did, play anything else. And just, you know, I think we're just kind of, I think that just might be it. So I'll give folks, you know, if anybody wants to call, now's your chance, 215-383-3832. I want to do live chat. I haven't done live chat for a while. Let me see if anybody wants to call in there. The Skype line's open also, so anybody wants to call in. In fact, we're going to have a friend of mine from New Zealand in the very near future. We're going to have another New Zealand call, so we'll talk to them in just a bit. So let me write down here the famous What's On Your Mind. And, you know, let's see what we got. On Your Mind. I'll put a question mark, give people a chance if they want to type in a live chat. And if you don't have an account with live chat, you look at the bottom of the Facebook page. Look at the bottom of the broadcast page at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. There's your live chat position. Feel free to join there. And seeing nobody call in. I assume people can call in because my reporters called in. And so I think that's it. Only about 25 minutes left. Anything I particularly want to cover? Yeah, there's lots of things, but I'd rather talk rather than just, I don't want to play anything else. I could play you Federalist number 10. Let me take a look at that one here. See if I can give you another Santa Rosa Volunteers. See if somebody calls in the next few minutes. Again, like I say, if nobody wants to chat, then have a good weekend. I play any Federalist number 10. Let me play Federalist number 10. Back in a little bit. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Federalist Number 10, published on November 22nd, 1787, is a continuation by James Madison of his dire warnings against domestic faction and insurrection. Interesting choice of words. That he began in Federalist Number 9. He engages in the same made-up predictions designed to generate fear for the purpose of ratifying the Constitution over updating the Articles of Confederation. Most of Federalist Number 10 is a total waste of time. It's recycled nonsense from previous papers, and it's boring. However, way down about halfway, it gets very interesting, and that is in the discussion of a democracy versus a republic. Madison says, "From this view of the subject, it may be concluded that a pure democracy, by which I mean a society consisting of a small number of citizens who assemble and administer the government in person, can admit of no cure for the mischiefs of faction. A common passion or interest will, in almost every case, be felt by a majority of the whole. A communication and concert result from the form of government itself. And there is nothing to check the inducements to sacrifice the weaker party or an obnoxious individual. Hence, it is that such democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths. Theoretic politicians who have patronized this species of government have erroneously supposed that by reducing mankind to a perfect equality in their political rights, they would at the same time be perfectly equalized and assimilated in their possessions, their opinions, and their passions." In other words, according to James Madison, democracies don't work. And he's absolutely right. You can't have perfect equality with equality of everything, everybody, every expectation, and every outcome. The only perfectly equal society is where everybody has equally had all their property and rights removed by a totalitarian government. So much for democracy. That's why the Constitution in Article 4, Section 4 declares that we are guaranteed a republican form of government. So let's see what Madison says about that. He says, "The two great points of difference between a democracy and a republic are, first, the delegation of the government, in the latter, to a small number of citizens elected by the rest, Secondly, the greater number of citizens and greater sphere of country over which the latter may be extended. The effect of the first difference is, on the one hand, to refine and enlarge the public views by passing them through the medium of a chosen body of citizens whose wisdom may best discern the true interests of their country and whose patriotism and love of justice will least likely to sacrifice it to temporary or partial considerations. The other point of difference is the greater number of citizens and extent of territory which may be brought within the compass of Republican than of Democratic government, and it is this circumstance principally which renders factious combinations less to be dreaded in the former than in the latter. Okay, well, that's all well and good. We are a republic, not a democracy. But how does this specifically relate to having a union under the new Constitution versus having a confederation under the old Articles? Madison doesn't say. Instead, he makes a rather large leap in talking about a large republic, which the United States would be given the expansion plans in the works. He wants you to assume that a large republic is better managed by the new Constitution over his predicted claims that under the Articles of Confederation, the Union will split into factions. That is really the heart of the hidden argument throughout this paper. He says, "Hence, it clearly appears that the same advantage which a republic has over a democracy in controlling the effects of faction is enjoyed by a large over a small republic, is enjoyed by the Union over the states composing it." By the Union over the states composing it? So much for federalism. This is a statement of a national government system supreme over the states, which was, I fear, the whole idea of the Constitution all along. Also, Madison offers no evidence or argument that a large republic is better than a small one. One would assume that if republics are the best form of government, they'd be good regardless of size. Also, missing is any evidence that the Constitution would prevent factions any better than the Articles of Confederation. I wonder how Madison would have explained the factions that created the Civil War under his very Constitution. Madison asks many rhetorical questions throughout this paper, which are designed to lead you to the appropriate rhetorical answers. However, the connection of questions to the probability of those actual events occurring in the answers is why I challenge his entire line of questioning. In his last argument for the Union under the Constitution, Madison actually argues the inferiority of states to control their factions over the national government, who would never let such factions spread to the other states. He says, "The influence of the factious leaders may kindle a flame within their particular states, but will be unable to spread a general conflagration through the other states. A religious sect may degenerate into a political faction in a part of the Confederacy, but the variety of sects dispersed over the entire face of it must secure the national councils against any danger from that source. A rage for paper money, for an abolition of debts, for an equal division of property, or for any other improper or wicked project will be less apt to pervade the whole body of the Union than a particular member of it, in the same proportion as such a malady is more likely to taint a particular county or district than an entire state." Well, the rage for paper money is causing economic suicide right now, but I digress. The Confederacy he talks about is under the Articles of Confederation in the 1700s. The Confederacy that seceded from the Union is in the 1860s under the Constitution. That was the greatest faction split of all. Would it have happened under the Articles of Confederation? Unfortunately, we will never know. In conclusion, out of nowhere, with no real evidence or arguments, just peripheral information and rhetorical questions that aren't relevant or even connected, Madison says that it is the character of the Federalist that makes the Constitution worth ratifying. He says, "In the extent and proper structure of the Union, therefore, we behold a Republican remedy
for the diseases most incident to a Republican government, and according to the degree of pleasure and pride we feel in being Republicans, ought to be our zeal in cherishing the spirit and supporting the character of Federalists. One has to wonder how Republican remedies will cure Republican diseases. Also, it is that character of the Federalists that the Anti-Federalists are challenging in every Anti-Federalist paper they write. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it.
Radio, dedicated to fixing everything.
Well, I'll certainly do the best I can. Only have, you know, however many decades left, you know, two or three, maybe we'll see, maybe four, who knows, medical science. But yeah, we got a lot of work to do, a lot of work to do, and no time like the present to do it. All right, so again, a couple of major topics this week. We went, like I said, we took on the whole transgender issue and proved that those words don't apply. We took on a bunch of different parties, whether we actually need political parties or not. So I found a lot of the sources, and this is what I find the most interesting thing about this argument, is that most of the parties comes from the left. It's like, you know, especially during the Trump administration, well, let's just get rid of the Republican Party. It was really kind of funny, actually. Or get rid of parties in general. What would we be like without parties? And it's an interesting thought. So, I urge everybody to unregister from the two main parties. You want to sign for the Greens or the Libertarians, I don't care. I wouldn't have any parties. And again, I would like to make a situation where nobody in a legislative office is allowed to belong to a party simply because it creates majorities within the houses and it conditions people to vote a certain way. That's why the Democrats vote one way, the Republicans vote another. Well, because they're parties. If they didn't have parties, they could vote freely what they wanted, and they'd be accountable to themselves and themselves only. They wouldn't have to be accountable to a party. So the BBC, let's get my British voice. So the BBC has an article here that says, can we have democracy without political parties? Well, democracy is not the goal, folks. Republic is. And so that's why this is a bogus article from the beginning that I don't want a democracy. I mean, democracy is the fastest road to tyranny. You know, people are you know, far too quick to vote themselves, you know, your rights, your money, you know, everything else. That's what democracy does. That's why socialist, communist, fascist, Nazis, they love democracies. They love democracies. You know, Hitler came to power in 1933 from a democracy. Okay. Mussolini came to power in Italy from a democracy. You know, all these things happen because of democracies. So, you know, you look at these, I don't know about the Russian Revolution. I think they just kind of stormed in. But for the most part, these dictatorships are elected. You know, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, I believe, was elected. Now, they might have cheated on the election. But the fact is, they didn't just walk into power with guns, you know, kill the previous party and sit in the chair and say, okay, I'm here. They didn't do that. So this is why dictatorships love democracy. So if you're a big fan of democracy, don't come talking to me. You just don't. It's just not good. No, it's not going to make it. All right. Anyway, so let's get back to my article here from the BBC. Future. Can we have democracy without political parties? And the article begins. This is by Catherine Ellison, 7th of June, 2021. So this is the last year's article, almost coming up on the one-year anniversary. And she says, around the world, voters appear to be turning away from traditional political organizations, but can democracy survive without them? In other words, can we have a democracy without political parties? Now, why would anybody even ask that question? What is it about political parties that make it necessary for a, quote, democracy? I don't know. You know, because political parties are the least democratic organizations out there. Even the Democratic Party is not democratic. Are you kidding? They all vote the same way. How can that be democratic? They require people to vote as they require people to vote. That's not democratic. If they're democratic, they say to their members, vote however you want. But they don't do that. So the least democratic, the Republicans don't either, but they seem to have defectors, like the three defectors, you know, Romney, Murkowski, and Collins that, you know, supported a racist Marxist to be on the Supreme Court. So when the Republicans defect from the party, they do it in such a grand style, but they make everything worse. I wish they'd just go away. I wish the Republicans had better control over their members, as long as you're going to have parties. Because the Democrats have real control over their members. All the Democrats voted for the Marxist racist, you know, Judge Jackson. So let's get going here. So the article says, in 1796, President George Washington lambasted the political parties for allowing cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men to subvert the power of the people. I don't know if he exactly said, I can't remember Washington ever saying the power of the people, but, you know, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. This is Catherine, what was her name now? Catherine Ellison, a very British name. Probably a white supremacist name. Ellison. Yeah, I like that. I mean, I'm just kidding. Don't mind me. I'm just joking around. All right. His indictment seems brutally timely today, just a few months after 147 Republican U.S. Congress members publicly challenged the results of the most recent U.S. presidential election. But even long before then, many Americans shared Washington's concern. Because what is she talking about? 147 Republican U.S. Congress members publicly challenged the results of the election. Those are the 147 that wanted the actual constitutional count of the states. This is January 6th, right? She's talking about January 6th. And the count was the constitutional count starting with Arizona. Well, Arizona never had its constitutional challenge. In fact, they cut it off. That was the whole point of having the Capitol Hill Invitational walk-in, to have Trump supporters walk in on top of the Capitol so they could cut off the actual constitutional challenge so they didn't have to deal with it. They didn't want to deal with it. Because if they had to deal with it, there was a good chance that Brandon would be voted out because the Trump electors would be put in because they came from the state legislatures, which is where you have to take the electors from anyway. So had the Constitution been followed, had the challenges been given, had the Brandon electors thrown out from the governors, secretaries of states, and attorney generals, and the proper Trump electors that came from the state legislatures been counted, then Trump would have gotten a second term. It's just that simple. So when she says 147 members of Congress challenged the election, that was their presidential duty. They're supposed to do that. 12 members of the Senate, 147 members of the House are the only people that should be in the House and Senate right now. The only ones that actually, you know, wanted to maintain the constitutional challenge. But this is the BBC. What do you expect? There's a bunch of propaganda, but it's kind of fun to read. She says the popularity of parties is at its nadir. I'd look that up. Nadir is the opposite of zenith. The zenith is the high point. Nadir is the low point. Parties that is nadir, with both Democratic and Republican parties in the U.S. widely condemned as not only unrepresentative, but also hijacked by elites. Well, that's actually very true on both parties, so I agree with her there. Indeed, a steadily increasing share of U.S. voters, 38% in 2018, identify as unaffiliated with either party, what we call independents. That proportion is now larger than the share of voters identifying with either Republicans or Democrats. Now, Republicans and Democrats together have more people representing them. So people in a party are larger than people not in a party. However, the people not in a party are growing. So the more people not in a party who register as independents, the better off we're all going to be. Excuse me. Article says it seems to be an international phenomenon. Yeah, this is why I thought this article was interesting, because as you know, the BBC is worldwide coverage, and that's what they pride themselves on, BBC, yes. So in Europe, for example, back to the article, traditionally powerful center-left parties, in other words, social democrats, are being accused of ignoring their voters, potentially contributing to a backlash that helped push the United Kingdom into Brexit. No, what pushed the United Kingdom into Brexit was a European Union tyrannical government. That's what did it, folks. All right. Anyway, article says the mounting animosity toward the parties has inspired debate among political scientists. Defenders of the traditional party system contend that democracy depends on strong, organized, and trustworthy political factions. See, there's that word faction again, which we talked about in the Federalist Papers. It's like the arguments don't change. You know, I think of factions, I think the faction they miss, though, is the faction of states unifying into four groups that I think Hamilton talked about in Federalist like four or five. So that's why I use that definition of faction. But it's also interchangeable with parties as factions, which is kind of interesting. And so they say without parties, we have chaos. Well, that's not true. In fact, probably the best period in our federal government was the time before the Civil War, after our founding, when they didn't have parties. It actually functioned better. Most of the mistakes were made after we got parties, which is kind of interesting. Since people in politics often try to go around parties, to go directly to the people. Oh, no, what a horror, go directly to the people. But without the parties, we'd have chaos. This is from Harvard University political scientist Nancy Rosenblum, who explores the challenges facing political parties today. Well, Nancy Rosenblum, why don't you defend why we have political parties? Let's see what you got. The article says, yet a small group of scholars, many of them young, exactly, say it's time to start visualizing a more open and direct democracy. No, you can't do that. Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution says we're guaranteed a republic form of government, not a democracy. So you can visualize your democracy all you want. It's illegal. Anyway, just thought I'd let you know. Most people don't know that democracies are illegal under the Constitution. Just a thought. Article says, with less mediation by parties and professional politicians. Oh, let me read the whole sentence. Yet a small group of scholars, many of them young, say it's time to start visualizing a more open and direct democracy with less mediation by parties and professional politicians. Well, I think less mediation by parties and politicians is a great idea, but the democracy is not. Article says such proposals were seen as completely fringe until a decade ago, says Helene Landemoor, a political scientist at Yale University. But events including the 2008 economic crisis and Donald Trump's 2016 election as president, well, that was an event, she says, have enlarged the scope of the debate. Oh, that should be interesting. Let's see what's happening with Trump there. Oh, here we go. So it says several trends have sped the declining popularity and power of the parties in the United States. Party-run patronage schemes that rewarded supporters with government jobs. Yeah, that's called, you know, graft, corruption, bribery. You know, party-run patronage schemes, you know, have long given way to more meritocracy, you know, systems based on merit. There we go. The rise of independent political action committees has given candidates a source of campaign funding, around $4.5 billion in the last decade, outside the party channels that once dominated access to campaign money. Okay, so whether it's dominated by people outside the party or inside the party, it's still dominated by somebody, which is kind of interesting. Article says this has made many candidates more entrepreneurial and less beholden to the party bureaucracy. Yeah, I don't think so, but we'll see. Article says, thirdly, parties now determine their candidates through primary elections instead of with meetings of party insiders. In other words, the old smoke-filled rooms, right? Just 17 primaries were held in 1968. Today, every state has a primary or a caucus, which actually is a good idea for a bad party system. So it's actually a better idea to have a caucus system than to just have a smoke-filled room where not only, at least in a primary, you have a chance to pick your party candidates from the ones they give you. So they give you so many choices, and you pick probably the worst of those choices, and then you pick the worst of the Democrat or Republican president. That's kind of how it works. That's why I want to get rid of parties. Anyway, this switch to universal primaries has shifted influence from party veterans to more extreme activists, in other words, Trump, who are more likely than average voters to vote in primaries. Oh, yeah, that's talking about the voters. And that's from Ian Shapiro, a political scientist at Yale. In 2018, the Democratic National Committee even cut back on the influence of superdelegates, the hundreds of party VIPs who also had votes in selecting candidates. Yeah, that's how Hillary won the nomination. She had a whole bunch of superdelegates that voted for her. What a surprise. Article says, in many parts of the United States, partisan gerrymandering has contributed to making candidates less representative of their constituents by creating, quote, safe seats for both parties. So the winners are, in fact, decided in the primaries that pit Democrats against Democrats and Republicans against Republicans. This phenomenon helps explain the 2018 election of Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, then a 28-year-old Democratic socialist and bartender, I added that, who had never before held elective office. Ocasio-Cortez beat an establishment Democrat in the primary, in which less than 12% of voters turned out. Well, that's fascinating. Not everyone agrees that political parties are weaker today than they once were. Today's extreme polarization means that much of the public is more strongly attached to their own party, says Rosenblum. And party-led voter suppression or voter mobilization efforts, in fact, make party leaders more powerful than ever. Yeah, I think I might leave it. Let's see if there's anything else I want to do here. I said when I get to the point where democracy depends on parties. I mean, I think I might find it here. Political parties are the core institution of democratic accountability because parties, not the individuals who support or comprise them, can offer competing visions of the public good. Oh, I wish I had more time for this. Political parties are at the core institution of democratic accountability. Well, that's a contradiction right there. Democratic accountability. The democratic process isn't accountable to anybody. People vote however they please. Majority wins, right? That's a democracy. And they said, this is Shapiro with his Yale colleague, Francis Rosenbluth, said because parties, not the individuals who support or comprise them, can offer competing visions for the public good. Well, as I said, there's no public good except what individuals choose. The sum total of individual choice is the public good. the public good is not determined by a government through social engineering, real or imagined crises, or anything else. Public good is not an excuse to take away your rights, yet that's what it's used for. Okay. So we said that not the individuals who support or comprise them can offer competing visions of the public good. Of course they can. Well, first of all, like I said, I offer a competing vision that public good is good. Okay. So then you take that into account, it's a whole different deal. So I don't want, I want people offering visions as individuals, not as a group. I don't want the group thing. Anyway, they say voters, they argue, have neither the time nor the background to research benefits of policies and weigh their personal interests against what's best for the majority in the long run. Well, what's best for the majority, again, this is this whole democracy idea. It's not what's best for the majority, it's what's best for individuals in the protection of rights, in the exercise of freedom, in the ability to have, low-cost goods and services like energy and things like that so you can maximize your life. That's what benefits the majority. But anyway, this group thing, you've got the Democrat majority, you've got the majority of Congress divided up into parties, you've got people divided up into parties so that it's majority rule. And this is the flaw in this entire argument, is this whole idea of democracy. Democracy sucks. Look at any nation that's gone to communism or socialism through democracy. They'll show you how bad it is. Anyway, I got 30 seconds left. What do I want to talk about? Maybe I'll pick it up next time. Yeah, because it talks about Proposition 13 as being a bad idea. That was the one in California that limited property taxes. That was actually the best thing that ever happened to California because they couldn't keep raising the property tax, so they couldn't, hike the houses even more. Let me hold it there. We've got about 20 seconds left. This has been a fascinating week. I'm kind of surprised nobody joined me on the phone. That's very unusual. But it has been a fascinating week. I hope there's my 10-second warning. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And again, next week, I should have more news for you on the Australian Bill of Individual Rights. I'll report on my Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Taylor Greene, meet and greet. And whatever else happens, we'll be there. And plus a whole bunch of legislation that you can act on by simply going to writeyourlaw.com, copying the link to the bill that you want, sending it to Congress, state legislators, local governments, members of the media, and talk show hosts. And that's how you do it. That's how you become an advocate. Share the bills, share the shows. Share the bills, once again, to Congress, state legislatures, local government, media, and talk show hosts, and share the shows to everybody. On that note, I'll be back Monday. Greg Penglis for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction, and also our website for legislation, writeyourlaws.com, writeyourlaws, writeyourlaws.com. And we'll be back at 6 o'clock in the morning Central Time Monday. That'll be 7 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Mountain, 4 o'clock Pacific, and the rest of the world, well, you guys will just figure it out.